the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are and why we are here and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the shining ones who lived on the earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in this series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Since ancient times, Egypt has expressed an irresistible spiritual magnetism on the hearts of millions of people. Experience 14 magic days in Egypt, exploring Cairo, the pyramids of Giza, and the temple of Dendera and Abydos with Maureen St. Germain. You cannot see it on your own as well as you can with this group. Click on the 14 Magic Days banner at X Squared Radio and join us in Egypt from October 6th through the 20th. Going to keep the phone lines open all night tonight, so toll free USA 877-876-5227, toll free anywhere in Canada 888-815-9756, and of course you can reach us anytime, whether you're on planet or off planet. If you can reach a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-876-3222. Tonight the solar wind is a mild 303 kilometers per second, and the sun, again, is absolutely blank today. No sunspots. There is a coronal hole that is streaming radiation mildly toward us now, but all is well. You might see an aurora borealis in the northern hemispheres. And the front runner for a $2 million NASA competition to build mock lunar landers has lost one of its two main vehicles in a fiery crash. The company Armadillo Aerospace says it will enter a smaller vehicle instead. But outsiders say the upset will level the playing field and add suspense to the upcoming contest. Should be interesting to see. And it's a good thing astronauts tend to be so fit and trim. In the future, they may have to don skin-tight spacesuits that, while flexible and lightweight, would be rather unforgiving to those of us who could stand to lose a few pounds. In the vacuum of space, there's not enough air pressure to keep fluids in the body from boiling, so astronauts need to wear pressurized spacesuits to prevent gas from building up in their tissues. Current spacesuits, however, are pressurized with gas and use multiple layers of fabric to keep the interior pressurized, but that makes them both bulky and heavy. They weigh about 300 pounds, and astronauts wearing them expend nearly 80% of their energy merely trying to bend the suits. Their new biosuit provides pressure by wrapping tight layers of spandex and nylon around the body, an idea first proposed by Paul Webb in the 1960s. See the 1968 New Scientist article, A Porous Leotard for Space. Kind of interesting. Those old spacesuits we saw in the 1955 through 58 movies are actually what they're going to be wearing. And on October 3rd, a train of giant waves rippled across the skies of Des Moines, Iowa. In view of Iowa Environmental Messenet video cameras, this is a kind of special atmospheric gravity wave called an undular bore. Researchers believe undular bores may be more common and more important than previously thought. Among the things they can do is collide with tornadoes and spin them up, turning ordinary twisters into F5 monsters. An undular bore passes over any given point in the United States about once a month, estimates Tim Coleman of the National Space Science and Technology Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Didn't know that. And Comet Linnaeus is plunging toward the sun, and solar heating is doing its work. Pieces of the 8th magnitude comet are boiling off. Comet Linnaeus makes its closest approach to the sun just outside the orbit of Mercury on October 29th. At that time, it may become faintly visible to the unaided eye. So get out there with your binoculars and your binocular chair, and you should be able to see that fuzzball with an increasingly active tail. Meanwhile, the comet is really, really good for a mid-sized backyard telescope. So if you want to get a picture of that, send it into X-Squared Radio. We'd be happy to have it. Last week, we ran an archive because I was working in Nashville. We had, the week before that, a psychic on named Nancy, and it was the first one we've ever had on this program, and right after that met another one named Michelle Denman, and we're trying to get her to come on the program. I'm kind of fascinated with the subject, have been for years, but haven't really found the right candidates for a scientific program as this to come on and try to convince us that they can see into the past or into the future or into other dimensions. But we'll try to bring those to you as much as we can. This week, we have a natural psychic, trained remote viewer, intuitive consultant, investigative reporter, and an accomplished award-winning director, screenwriter, and film and TV producer. In 1985, tired of the fast-paced life in Los Angeles, he went on a worldwide spiritual quest, which led him to England and Ireland, where he became involved with the Green Stone Saga, one of the stones in the hilt of Excalibur. And he first achieved national recognition when his expeditions to Area 51 made front-page news in newspapers across America, including the L.A. Times. He is now a guest on X Squared Radio. Please welcome my friend Sean David Morton. How are you, Sean?
Hey, Brooks, my brother. How you doing? Very, very, very mysterious. Very interesting. Fantastic stuff. It's very nice. It's like It's great. It's like Rod Serling meets Howard K. Smith. It's a fantastic combination.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Well, we try to, you know, bring the best science news so that people can stay up to date to that, and we delve into the mysteries of the universe and the Earth here a little bit different than most radio broadcasters. I don't come from the broadcasting field. I was kind of hooked into it when the first book went ballistic. I was invited to speak on the radio so much. Finally, Don contacted me and said, "Hey, how would you like to have your own radio program?"
Oh.
And innocent as I was, I said, "Sure," and here I am 3 years later still doing it.
And it's been going fabulously well ever since.
Yes, it has. It's been a lot of fun. That's the most important part.
Good.
Hey, Sean, earlier this year, you and I were talking at the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And I told you about the trip I was planning to take in Tibet.
Uh-huh.
And you asked me to seek out the dragon root ray in the Patala.
Okay.
So when I got on the... on the tour, and let me tell you, this was no vacation. It was
yeah.
a really tough expedition.
It's hard. I pity anybody that goes through it, especially if you're kind of walking through it, whatever. I've actually never been to Tibet. I've been through Nepal, and that was difficult enough when I was 25, 26 or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Nepal, it starts at 8,000 feet and goes up.
Yes.
But when we got off the jet, we were at 11,500 feet.
Right.
So our guide said, "Walk to the hotel room and go to bed."
Yes.
And there were some people that didn't heed the advice, and they ended up with altitude sickness. But about we were there for 14 days. We did the overland tour in four-wheel drives across the Tibetan Plateau.
Wow.
And one of the places that we toured was the Patala in Lhasa.
Okay.
Now, of course, many people don't know this was the tallest building in the world until about 100 years ago. These people, it was amazing how they used the resources of their surroundings to build this magnificent structure.
Uh-huh.
Well, my guide took us up the stairs into this Patala, and he's been there, I guess, more than 50 times, so he tells the story, and he's old enough to have done that. He says that he asks the communist guards, the Chinese guards that man the all the tourist attractions there in Tibet. And, you know, you sort of take the government tour. There are doors they let you through and hallways they let you down, and there's other doors that are blocked. But you had kind of sent me on a mission, so my intention was very strong to get into these, you know, the bowels of the Patala.
Right.
And lo and behold, we get about halfway through the tour, and the Chinese guard says, "Okay, I'll let your group behind these double doors, but no one else." And we about freaked out. I mean, my jaw was on the floor. I was like, "Oh, my God." You know, Sean was right. And so they opened up the doors, and they let our group in and closed them behind us, and it was kind of dark. Took a while for our eyes to get used to it. And we started down this spiral staircase, and it was in a counterclockwise Fibonacci ratio.
Right, yes.
One step, then two, then three, then five, and all the way to the bottom. And I stepped off on what we would call a swastika, but obviously this was many, many centuries before,
it's a swastika. It's, you know, it's what they use.
Yeah, so, and this is like 7th century stuff.
Yeah.
So you step off on the swastika, and in the middle is this big old chunk of turquoise.
Okay.
And by the time your eyes get used to the light, there in front of us was this 20-meter-high gold stupa.
Uh-huh.
Made. It was over 4,000 pounds of gold, over 10,000 gems, and in it was interred the body of a Dalai Lama.
Did they tell you which one?
I believe it was the 5th Dalai Lama.
Okay.
So, I really didn't know it. They couldn't sit on the floor, so I stood there and meditated for about 10 minutes, like you asked me to.
Right.
And it was unbelievable, the power, the vibrations in this area. I mean, a human probably hasn't stood there in, I don't know, 20 years.
Yes.
But I got the feeling that there was some high technology behind this, and when I opened my eyes, it hit me. The darn thing looked exactly like a Tesla coil.
Yeah, Actually, that's what the interesting enough. That's what the Vajras, the Vajras or Dorjis, depending on which you know, how you want to translate it. But those are very much replicas of some kind of electrical device. But that's fantastic that they actually let you in. It's just to give the people listening a little background. When you and I talked about this, we talked about the Tibetan theory that there are six major chakra points on the planet, and that the base root chakra of the world is, in fact, Lhasa Tibet, the Patola at Lhasa Tibet, and it is at the five sacred mountains in Tibet and Nepal that the masculine aspect of the god ray strikes the planet, and that is at Annapurna, Sugarmatha, which is also known as Mount Everest, Chongori, which is also known as K2, Annapurna, Amadam Lam, which was actually the mountain right outside of the monastery that I used to live in Tengpache, which is right on the border of it's in Nepal, right on the border of Tibet, and Durga Lama, which are the five sacred mountains, with the Patola acting as the frequency transformer, if you will, the step down transformer for the masculine aspect of the god ray, which is one of the reasons why you had a primarily male based monastic system in Tibet. You had the colors. It's interesting because I went to USC, and the colors of USC are cardinal and gold, and also the colors of the Tibetan lamas are also cardinal and gold, which are first and second chakra colors. So the idea was that you had these monks there that were doing series of meditations to actually process the masculine aspect of the god ray in order to act as step-down transformers to make that energy or power available to the rest of the planet. The female aspect of the god ray supposedly strikes in with the center point being Machu Picchu, and in South America, because that's the female balance, the lungs of the planet, if you will. So it's the Dalai Lama was a very important person there. The monastery that I lived in, Tangbache, the Black Hat monks moved out of Tibet in the 8th century because of a whole series of prophecies that said that in the end times, that at the very end of the age of the Kali Yuga, the age of iron or the age of pain, that the Dalai Lama would be driven from the land of snows, that the great dragon of China would reawake, that it would swallow Tibet, that the Dalai Lama must be driven from the land of snow so that the ocean of wisdom, which is actually what Dalai Lama means, can be it could be poured out upon the rest of the world. And actually the Black Hats for many years chided and criticized the Tibetan government for not being more open to the West and not opening up their wisdom and their knowledge and their compassion to outsiders, saying that if they were not more open with the world, that it would lead to their destruction. The rest of the prophecy, I think, is very interesting because it talks about how in the last days, again, at the end of the Kali Yuga, at the end of the Age of Pain, at the beginning of the Golden Age, if you will, that we would actually have there would be a mass slaughter of people in Tibet. There, I think there were anywhere between about 3 and 3.5 million people killed in Tibet when the Chinese came in, and that there would be a mass transmigration of souls. And in the 8th century, the prophecy said that that this transmigration of souls would lead to a mass reincarnation of souls in the land of the red man. And they said that in the land of the red man is when is where the true religion of the future would actually take hold. And I think that pretty much is a prophecy about the United States. And I also think that it's also why the Dalai Lama, also the fact that he's born July 6th, and the United States is a Cancer or moon child country, the Dalai Lama has been accepted as such royalty here, and also why we have the phenomenon of various Tibetan masters and saints and lamas and whatever actually incarnating as children here in the United States. So everything that you saw there is also about ready to be popularized in the next Indiana Jones movie as well, because the next Indiana Jones movie is actually called Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls, and supposedly the Tibetans had 13 crystal skulls that were placed around different areas that had energy and information actually stored in the skull. So that's an amazing experience that you got to actually go there and you got to see that and you got to process that energy. What were your just be kind of interested after you did your meditations there, and after you saw that this was kind of a an electrical technology or a Tesla technology, if you will, what other impressions did you get of the planet or the world while you were standing in front of it?
Well, it wasn't so much while I was standing in front of it, but later we ended up in a chanting hall that was built in 1027. Fantastic place. Of course, there's no heat in any of these places,
yeah,
and it's rather cold up there. So the monks let us sit in the back row and put on some of their real warm wool robes and sit in the back and listen while they chanted. Then they allowed us to chant with them, and that lasted for about 40 minutes, and we got some of that on film. And then as I exited the place, they said, now, you need to exit clockwise, and when you do, there's a holy man, a high lama, buried under this stone, and over the stone is this kind of tube that comes out of the ceiling made of layered fabric. They call it a portal. They call it a soul portal in their language.
Okay.
And they said, when you walk over the gravestone of this high lama, look up into the tube. Well, nobody did it. Everybody was walking through there. But I stopped, and I looked up into the tube. I swear, Sean, I saw stars up in that tube.
Wow.
It was an amazing story that they told about this building, too, that there were huge timbers used as pillars to hold up the ceiling in this chanting hall. Well, you know Tibet. I mean, there's no trees. You're like a mile above the tree line.
Right, yes.
So they tell a story how they went and got these trees. They sent a small party, horses and wagons, many, many miles away to where the forests were, and they spoke to the trees. And the trees spoke back and said, they asked them questions, why do you want to end my life? Why do you want to cut me down? And they said, well, we're going to use you as support timbers in our chanting hall, in our holy place up in the mountains. And the tree said, then I agree, you can take my life. So as they cut into the tree bled, and they hauled it up there, and they stood it up, and the actual wood of this tree is blood red. It's not been painted either. It's just red.
Huh.
And it's about 24 inches in diameter.
Wow.
A really big piece of timber. So I'm going to say that the feeling that I had really took my voice away. I was trying to shoot a documentary there, but I got to tell you, sometimes it took 7 or 8 takes to get something recorded because I'd get so choked up speaking about it that it was just overwhelming. There was great power there.
Yes.
And well, the higher we went in the mountains, the more disconnected we became with the 3D.
Well, it's also, I mean, that's really the shame of the Chinese invasion, because you can imagine what that was like when you had people there actually as caretakers of that power and ability. And I'm convinced to this day that the reason that was such a priority for Mao and his Chinese murderous thugs to take over that area of the world was primarily because he was gaining control of the root chakra of the planet, and that by getting control of the root chakra, one could control the dragon force or energy, and it is believed that one could, in fact, one could rule the world once one ruled Tibet. And actually, just from the, let's take it out of the spiritual realm, if you just go into the geologic realm, anybody that controls Tibet also controls the headwaters of the Ganges and controls the headwaters of a series of rivers that are essential to all of Asia Minor. So just as a geographic point for future war, you could probably dam up all the water that's coming out of Tibet and probably kill the entire continent of India if you wanted to, or large chunks of Asia Minor. So
unbelievable.
It's just a very interesting aspect of this, that here you had a fledgling revolution in China, and yet the first thing they embarked on was the destruction of Tibet. And of course today, when the Dalai Lama left in 59, and then you had the Panchen Lama left later on. I think the Karmapa, who was the leader of the sect of Tibetan Buddhism that I was involved with for a while. He left in, I think, 1996 or so, and the big story between the two of them. But it's just very interesting that you now have the Chinese actually breeding the Tibetans out of existence.
They really are.
They're not allowed. You could do a whole show just on the Tibetans, but it's the Chinese are allowed to have as many children as they want. They're allowed to practice polygamy in certain areas so that they could have more kids. If a Tibetan woman marries a Tibetan man, when he dies, their property goes to the state, whereas the Chinese are allowed to pass property down. So in about 20 years or so, there's just not going to be a Tibet. People are going to say free Tibet, and the Chinese are going to say, what Tibet? It's all Chinese now.
Right.
You know, kind of like they're doing in Canada or the Pacific Northwest or, you know, anywhere else in these major cities in the world, Australia.
Well, one of the things that I noticed...
breeding everybody out.
One of the things you notice when you do the overland tour with a four-wheel drive across this area is the tremendous road-building program that's going on there.
Uh-huh.
But it's not a road-building program like we're used to.
Right.
About every 2 miles, there's a tent, and in the tent lives the road crew.
Right. Uh-huh.
And we're talking about people working on the road with a sledgehammer, wearing slacks and loafers. And everywhere we went, it was exactly like that. And although it was barren, to a geologist, and I'm not a geologist, but I've worked around them most of my life, all I could see was iron and tin, uranium, some gold, copper, zinc, mountains and mountains and mountains of minerals. And so I could see that the Chinese are building roads to a gold mine of minerals.
Uh-huh.
And very soon they're going to start hauling it out of there.
Well, and of course, again, leads you to Asia Minor, leads you into the Hindu Kush and into Afghanistan and India and, you know, and all kinds of places. It's just the Tibet really is the crossroads of the world, and it is of interest that, so much of Tibetan culture is a combination of Europe and China and India, and they have a medical system that was very famous at the time because the king of Tibet invited the best doctors from China, the best ones from Europe, and the best ones from India, and then locked them all in a castle and said, I'm not letting any of you go until you come up with a system that is the best of the best of all three of your systems. And the Tibetans of interest were probably the most badass militarily. They had a hyper-advanced form of martial arts. They were like, 10-0 as far as, they beat up the Mongols, they beat up the Chinese. They were the ultimate militaristic warrior society up until they accepted Buddhism in the 8th century, which was then they saw that they looked into the future, if you will, and said that the ultimate expression of a militaristic society is the ultimate conquest and destruction of the world. And they understood at that time that they switched to a peaceful aspect of Buddhism and actually gave up the arts of war, which was kind of an amazing thing. It's sort of like if the United States today simply said, well, if we keep on going the way we're going and just keep taking over country after country after country, then obviously the be-all and the end-all of this is going to be global destruction. And the United States simply just saying, well, we're just not going to have armies or navies or anything like that anymore, and just literally turning the swords into plowshares. And the first country in the world that actually did this was Tibet, which just says a lot for the advancement of their social systems and whatever else in their philosophy. They also have a culture, too, that even though the Tibetans are very much influenced by Confucianism, technically their culture and their civilization hasn't really been interrupted for about 40,000 years or so. You know, it goes back a really long time. So it's... they didn't have the same kind of, they were isolated from the same kind of floods and the same kind of global earth changes that the rest of the world had that wiped out many cultures and civilizations throughout that time. So anyway, congratulations. I think that's certainly the trip of a lifetime, and certainly well worth doing. And I can't wait to see your movie on it. I'm sure it'll be fantastic.
Yeah, well, the DVD that we produced called The Inner Earth Expedition Part 1, although it's only 31 minutes long, we experimented with shorter ones and longer ones, and we found the longer ones, people just couldn't take that much data. They started falling asleep, heading for the fridge, stuff like that. So we made it 31 minutes, and it seems to be just exactly the right length. It has a little bit of everything. It's kind of hollow earth theory for dummies. And it has a lot of the Tibetan footage in it, and the footage is stuff that you're just not going to see anywhere.
Right.
Let me give you a couple of examples. You were talking about King Gompo back in the 7th century.
Right.
It is true that they had conquered 9 nations. One of them included China. And
they didn't conquer China. They fought China.
They said
conquer China. They fought China. They fought China to a standstill. They fought the Mongols. They fought whomever.
But they still, you know, requested to marry 9 of the princesses of these countries, and they could bring with them part of their culture,
yes.
And thus Tibetan Buddhism was kind of born, and King Gompo produced the first written language for the Tibetans.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So in looking at some of their really, really old art, you see some of these characters levitating, and they have really big foreheads, and, you know, you know that these people are not, you know, all from Earth,
right.
That they're really dealing with some off-worlders or maybe some inner-worlders. There's a whole lot of art about openings into the inner Earth,
okay.
In their stuff. In fact, if you look at the symbol for Tibetan Buddhism, it looks like a hollow Earth. You got a yin and yang in the center with some rays of light coming out, and then a foliage ring around the outside. And it's really fascinating the way the human is tied into the planet. It's just really fascinating how they do that. And the fact that they really teach creation, real creation, the whole creation story. Their mandalas are divided into 108 sections, each of which, if you meditate on them, and I guess the monks do it by making sand mandalas, so they very carefully meditate on each one as they're pouring it out.
Well,
I mean, they're fantastic
there's
to look at.
There's tankas that are up on the walls that you meditate on and all that. But
oh, yeah. And this whole idea of an icon bringing about a physiological effect in a human being goes way, way back. In fact, it was the medieval church that went out and started destroying the icons because it was allowing people to have individual access to higher states.
Uh-huh.
And the church didn't want that. They wanted to be the sole source of these higher states.
Exactly, yeah.
So, you know, bringing this forward to world conquest and world domination, it's pretty clear that one of the most intact and beautiful forms of worship, real linking the human being to the cosmos, had to be wiped out in order to establish this world dominion. Because you can't dominate a people who are free in their minds.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I saw in the Tibetans. I saw these people who were quite happy with their lot, even though, by our standards, it's pretty miserable.
Right.
Because you can't imprison a person who has a direct connection to the cosmos.
No.
So
yeah, you can't get a whole lot of work out of them either, too. So you can't just have monks in caves sitting here communing with Godhead all the time. It's a very weird thing. Actually, the one thing that may help with your documentary and your theory was that, again, when I was in Nepal and I was at Tangpache, the Tibetans have technically the Nepalese, the Buddhists, whatever you would call them, the Black Hats have a whole series of theories about, which also relate directly to Tibetan culture, about two huge underground complexes, or should I say underground inner earth areas that they call Agharta Major and Agharta Minor. And they talked about Agharta Minor was underneath the Gobi Desert, and Agharta Major was a huge veldt or cave or subcontinent, if you will, underneath the Himalayas. And we actually took a trip while I was there studying that took us about 3 days to get down and about 4 days to get up. But we went through a series of tunnels down in through the mountain and did a series of meditations in front of about a 60-foot-tall circular stone door that looked like a bank vault, kind of, that had it had an odd face on it. It looked like sort of a crying, instead of like a happy face, it was like a sad face with all these rays coming out of it, with tears coming out of the side of it. And we went down there, we did a series of meditations in front of this door. I had my experiences of what I saw, which was I never saw anything directly, but it's just very weird that then you come out of the meditation and everybody's seeing the same thing that you've seen. So that, I guess, would confirm the reality of this. But the interesting part about this is that for many, 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 many years, the Tibetans have had the Agharta Major and Agharta Minor mythology. And then the Red Chinese in 1989, and this was reported on in Time and think it was Time Magazine at that time, the Red Chinese were doing a series of atomic tests. And part of the atomic tests were linked to a series of scientific experiments that were specifically designed to get a kind of a holographic idea of the landmass of the Earth and the planet. And the bottom line of this whole thing was is that with these atomic tests reported on in Time Magazine, that the Chinese had actually physically discovered and in fact proved through this sonic testing that Agharta Major and Agharta Minor did in fact exist, and that they were two very large subcontinents directly underneath the Gobi Desert and the Himalayas. So, you know, there you go. I don't know if that... The Tibetans also talked about how they were the guardians of the gateways to hell, and that the gates to hell were actually in the Himalayas, and that these various tunnels leading down underneath the earth were the realm of what they called the Naga Sarachi, or the royal serpent men, as they called them. So
really?
They were reptilian beings underground. They had a very interesting theory. They talked about how the mammals were underground and the dragons were above ground, and then when a great catastrophe or a great star fell from the sky, i.e. the comet that struck the Yucatan 65 million years ago, that the mammals came up to the surface and that the dragons went underground, and that they have somehow evolved right along with us, and that these serpent men look, they're bipedal and they're, you know, sort of tall and thin, and they look kind of like the Geico lizard. They can stand up on two legs and run about, and science has later confirmed a lot of what the Tibetans believed, a lot of that mythology, because they said, well, if dinosaurs had continued to evolve for 65 million years, they would probably have two arms, two legs, be bipedal, they would probably still have tails, they would walk upright, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So this is very interesting, the scientific facts and data, if you dig hard enough, that actually confirms a lot of your experiences and confirms a lot of things that the Tibetan mythology that is or was later confirmed by hard science.
Well, it's kind of interesting that Dr. Y Sessions with Washington University employed a few of his grad students to go through 600,000 seismograms generated by the USGS.
Okay.
And darned if they didn't discover, after deciphering all that data, another ocean underneath the Atlantic Ocean.
Really?
And that was that was actually published in mainstream newspapers earlier this year. I've communicated with Dr. Y Sessions and asked him if he or any of his grad students would love to have this once-in-a-lifetime chance to go to the North Pole and look for this oceanic depression or some thinning of the crust or a gravity anomaly. And so far he said he's just a little too busy. His schedule is too busy.
Well, that might make a lot of sense. The Atlantic is, there was a theory for many years that the moon had supposedly thrown out of the Atlantic, because the Atlantic is kind of like a big, it's almost like somebody took a big ice cream scoop out of it, and the moon is approximately the same size as this ice cream scoop out of the Atlantic. And, of course, then when the Apollo missions went and they found that the moon, and I think this was actually rather underplayed by a lot of this, but they found that the moon did in fact come from outside the solar system.
Right, right.
In fact, made up of various types of materials like helium-3 that were extrasolar, if you will, not extraterrestrial, but extrasolar, which makes the moon even a bigger mystery, because it means this, that it is the second largest moon in the solar system, and next to Io. And it also means that it basically just not only wandered in here, but somehow managed to perfectly park itself in orbit in a perfectly circular, not elliptical orbit around the Earth. Let me just finish my thought.
Okay.
The thought was that if there was something that was impacting the Atlantic, then it would be interesting, because you would probably have, I mean, you know, if something actually kind of smushed down the ocean that was there and impacted it, I'm just kind of wondering how a secondary ocean underneath the Atlantic would actually work as far as...
Well, what they were picking up were the damping waves of another sea deep underneath the Atlantic Ocean. They were actually getting the echo back from another ocean.
Wow.
Which is pretty remarkable. And also, another thing that was underplayed, you can actually only find a few hits on this on the net, and that is the fact that when the first Eagle lander... Well, actually, the second Eagle lander took off. they left some geophones back behind. They
are you talking
through
about the seismographs on 11 and 12?
Yeah.
On the moon, on the Apollo mission.
Yeah, right. And what they did is they jettisoned the fuel tank, which fell back to the moon. And
well, that was actually, you got the story a little confused. What happened was that there were actually seismographs that were left on the base units of the lunar modules of 11 and 12. When Apollo 13 got in trouble, and there were some who believed that there was actually an atomic weapon on Apollo 13, but when Apollo 13 got in trouble, it actually ejected its entire package, the entire command module and everything else that they needed. So they had an exact moment of when all of the packages that were jettisoned by Apollo 13, so the astronauts could basically salvage everything and actually get home alive. When something happened to their ship, they knew when this thing was going to bounce off the surface. And Walter Cronkite, who's a friend of mine, and I used to go sailing with him a long time ago, but Cronkite made a very famous comment about how tonight the moon rang like a bell for almost 8 solid hours as the Apollo 13 retro package crashed into the lunar surface. And of interest, and this is detailed in Donald Wilson's books, Somebody Else is on the Moon, I'm sorry, Secrets of Our Starship Moon and Secrets of Our Spaceship Moon, Volumes 1 and 2. He talked about how when the retro rocket package actually crashed into the lunar surface, a couple of interesting things happened. First off, that the speed of the sound actually was traveling at between about 3,000 and 5,000 feet per second, which meant that the surface of the moon, the surface 28 miles of the moon, was approximately mostly iron ore and various types of oxides and fairly common dirt. But then the sonic frequencies of the moon, when the moon rang like a bell for this 8 hours or so, then began to pick up between 48,000 and 52,000 feet per second, which is what sound travels through a combination of titanium and yttrium. So this gives a very interesting version of the moon, that in fact the moon seems to have been, number one, parked in orbit. Number two, it's the second largest. It's almost the size of Pluto. It seems to have been parked in orbit, has a perfectly circular orbit, seems to have about 28 miles of dirt on the top of it. By the way, the depths of all the various craters are almost exactly the same, which is another weird thing about the moon. The moon, the front surface of the moon is pockmarked with very, very large craters, all of which are about the same depth. And the backside of the moon is virtually crater-free. In fact, the only large crater on the backside of the moon is a crater in the southern region, which looks like a stop sign. It actually has edges on it, and it's a gigantic hexagon in the lower backside of the moon, almost as if you had a gigantic hexagonal-shaped tube, if you will, actually attached into the back of the moon, and the moon was actually pushed forward and quite possibly parked in orbit. There is a UFO theory behind this, that the moon actually came from Epsilon Eridani. When Epsilon Eridani went supernova about 80,000 years ago. The other theory is, too, that NASA scientists actually did a series of mathematical calculations on the moon, because if the moon has a perfectly circular orbit, then we can figure out how long it's been there by how the orbit has decayed into an ellipse. And when they actually did the math on it, they found that the moon had only arrived fairly recently, about their best guesstimates were between about 76,000, about 80,000 years or so ago, and which also relates into Zachariah Sitchin's thing about supposedly every 36,000 years you have some big comet that comes through, or some, you know, some 12th planet or whatever. And the rest of the mythology goes is that the Asiatic peoples, which leads us back to Tibet, that the Asiatic peoples supposedly came here inside the moon, which is one of the reasons why China or Sinai, later called Cathay by the British, actually means people of the moon, and they directly relate the descendants of the kings and queens, the children of heaven, as they call themselves, these celestials, as having actually come here inside the moon. And actually, when the Chinese came to the United States, we didn't even call them Chinese. We called them celestials, because that's what they called themselves.
Well, how significant is it that the side of the moon that faces the Earth is dark with iron dust, and the side that faces away from the moon is actually about six times, or away from the Earth, is actually about six times brighter?
You mean
the albedo of the moon, the amount of energy that it reflects back out into space?
Right.
On the far side of the moon, it's about 60%, whereas the side that faces Earth is only about 10%.
Interesting.
So
I did not know that.
Well, one of the astronomers, his name is Tom Van Flandern, he's very well published, has a theory called the Black Axiom, or he talks about it in his book. And this is a, when the Earth goes through, when the solar system goes through the galactic plane, it actually passes through a cloud of dark matter.
Right.
And it coats everything in the solar system.
Oh, okay.
The very slow rotating bodies sort of get a half paint job.
Right, and because
the moon
rotates on its axis once every 28 and a half days, then
right.
You get a slower paint job. That's very, very interesting.
So if the far side of the moon faced us on a full moon, we'd probably have to wear sunglasses.
Could it also mean, here's another theory for you, the other theory would be is that let us assume that the moon was traveling face forward, with all the stuff actually pocking off the front of it as it moved through space.
Yeah.
It could actually be that the backside of the moon is more of what the moon is actually made of and more of what it, and more of what it actually looked like, whereas the front side of the moon with all these big craters.
Because it's on the leeward side.
Yeah, exactly. Because you know, it's like, you know, why is a boat the different a different color on the bow than it is on the stern? If the bow is constantly pounding up against the waves, the discoloration or anything that moves through space or through water or through air is actually going to get a discoloration on the front, and of course maybe have the coating actually knocked off. Well, it just goes to show you, Brooks, that it's a strange universe and we just work here, and as the motto of the old TV show used to go. But the idea of the of all of this is that it's one of the reasons why they call people lunatics, because the more you study the moon, the more you realize that it just shouldn't be there. And it is probably the greatest mystery in the solar system, and yet we've just completely kind of ignored it and glossed over it as just being a big, hunky, spaceless rock. And I think they're telling us a bunch of lies about the science of the moon, and I think we've got all kinds of stuff up there. And there's... I don't know whether or not it's military bases. I don't know if it's... there's a whole room that I've been to in the London Royal Library that's basically all lunar phenomenon and things about lights on the moon and storms on the moon and all kinds of crazy things dating back hundreds of years. So,
well, what about the ideas from our friend Mr. Hoagland that there are actually bases on the other side of the moon?
Yeah, they're all over the place. I mean, that's not even hard. They're all over the place. It depends on whose they are. Whether or not we got there and moved into them. In essence, if you actually read H.G. Wells, if you read First Men in the Moon, a lot of what H.G. Wells said was right. I mean, it was kind of uncanny that his three astronauts take off in a bathysphere, even though the bathysphere is covered with, I think, anti-gravity paint, as I remember.
I remember that. Fantastic movie.
Yeah, but remember, they were the ones they took off in a bathysphere. There were three of them. They took off from Florida. There were certain parts of the moon that they could actually get out and walk around that had certain amounts of atmosphere, that most of the beings there actually lived underground in a whole series of kind of caves and honeycombs, which turned out to be scientifically accurate. I mean, and then you go into the, the UFO contactee information, and you talk to, and you get information coming from the grandfather of UFO contactees, George Adamski. And Adamski in the early 1950s gave us a detailed, very, very accurate description of the backside of the moon, about 15 years or so before we'd actually seen it. He gave us very accurate descriptions of what space flight was like. He told us that there weren't really any stars in space. Everything looked kind of black and inky, that the saucer he was riding in was riding out of the atmosphere, that he saw these weird kind of, he called them fireflies, these sort of like twinkle lights all around the outside of it, which were then discussed at length by John Glenn and a lot of his orbits around the moon. So it's really a lot of fun, because when you study metaphysics, whether or not you're studying Buddhism or metaphysics or UFO information, it really is a I wouldn't call it science fiction because it's not really made up, but you really are studying the future. I mean, you're looking at where we're going to be in the future. 20 some odd years ago, we had photos of UFOs with blue beams coming out of the ships and the saucers, and today we have blue beams or blue rays that are reading DVD discs or high def Blu-ray discs. It's very, very interesting to me that I've learned so much from the UFO field and so much from talking to contactees and scientists and abductees and researchers and what have you, because in my studies of this since like 19, well, actually when I was a kid, my dad was a PR director for TRW, and you know I have a couple of godfathers that have walked on the moon, and you know very good friends that I was very very close friends with a lot of the Gemini, Mercury, and the Apollo astronauts. Neil Armstrong graduated from USC, and I got to meet him when I was in college because he came and spoke at the university, and so just a you know fascinating group of guys that. Ed Mitchell is a good friend, and he runs the Noetic Sciences Institute. Although he had a big kind of come to Jesus meeting, because when he and I first met, you know, he thought all this metaphysical stuff was you know all a bunch of crap, and there wasn't any proof for any of it. Now he's totally singing a different tune. So it's been fascinating for me studying places like Area 51 and talking to people like you know like Bob Lazar and guards and people out there that. I've seen the future. I mean, I've seen where we're going as a lot of this stuff has become declassified, and as science is moving more and more in that direction. It as for myself, as a futurist and somebody whose job it is to predict the future and see where various future trends are going, it has been a really fabulous education for me because I'm not surprised. I know what's coming next. I've seen. You know, I saw the future of genetic engineering in 1989 when we were studying the Dulce Archuleta Mesa, and we had film of what appeared to be beings being cloned inside the mesa. We had a piece of film of a scientist that was actually crossbreeding genetic material from plants and laboratory animals at that time, which later became the basis of a lot of these Frankenfoods and genetic engineering, a lot of the stuff that you know Monsanto and Pharmacia are up to. You know, I saw the future of what was going on with the military by going out to places like Area 51 and seeing the disc technology and the flying saucer stuff for myself. Even though it was very interesting to get caught up into the massive series of lies and propaganda campaigns that then began to be put out by corporate mouthpieces like Popular Science magazine and Popular Mechanics and these you know these hack shills that parked themselves out there in the town of Rachel, Nevada, and began to rob and steal and, you know, lie about everybody and smear everyone just so they could cover up the truth as to what we'd seen and claim, oh, it's just stealth technology and it's just aircraft and there's nobody that's seen the aliens on the base and, you know, there's no such thing as all that. All these guys are liars and fakes and fools and all that stuff. And, you know, beginning the massive amount of smear and slander that you see on the web of anybody that's had anything to do with Area 51.
Oh, yeah. Then you have the people actually in the genre, so to speak, that have made big names for themselves and lots of money. And yet when it comes to, you know, validating any of the information with anyone else's information, they immediately begin to submarine anyone else around them and attack them. And then you have to wonder, gee, you know, is the government actually planting people in the genre, acting like experts and befriending a lot of these people who have some of this very proprietary technology, and then as soon as they reveal the heart and soul of their technology, they're immediately attacked or audited or you know attacked by the IRS.
I've seen some of that happen. Yet on the other hand, if you put a bunch of UFO researchers in a room together and just buy them beer, they'll all kill each other. although, you know, actually, I shouldn't say that because that goes back to the bad old days of guys like, you know, Bill Cooper, who had some very, very bad psychological problems, and you know, some of the people back there. Now it's just it's a way for relative unknowns. I mean, obviously, the internet has introduced us to this mad rush towards mediocrity, and so anybody that can make a series of outrageous claims that they can't back up or smear anybody automatically tries to put themselves on the same level as the person who has actually done the work and done the research and
is
actually out there trying to do something, as far as pressing back the envelope of human knowledge and information. And you know, and unfortunately, the internet is just since the internet is kind of a the field of UFOs is like running through a swamp of luminous weeds. That ultimately ends up in a black wall that's kind of covered with Zen cones, if you will. And yet the other idea is that you know any trek through the internet is like trekking through the muck and the mire, you know. And you play with poop and you get poop on you, as they say. So
well, you have to be somewhat discriminatory.
Well, actually, my opinion is I look for the people getting smeared because I figure if somebody's getting smeared and somebody's getting slandered, then that means they're the closest people to the truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I look for that. I look for, well, you know, who's dissing this guy? Or who's dissing so-and-so? And then I go, oh, okay, well, maybe now they're on to something. If they've taken enough time to lie about these people and lie about these individuals, then that person certainly must be close to something, because they say if you're only taking heat when you're close to the fire, as they say.
Yeah, yeah. On the other hand, you and I have been to a lot of conferences, and you do see people that get up and make presentations, and it's pretty clear that the closest they've been to the subject is their local computer and a pair of pajamas.
You know, in some cases, I mean, I see that in some aspects. I mean, when I got into this, I had the advantage of first off knowing a bunch of astronauts and having a background with people involved in NASA and TRW and Northrop and Rocketdyne and all this stuff. Just when I was a kid, I mean, growing up, I was exposed to all this. Then years later, in 1989 and 1990, I was asked to, I keep saying co-direct and co-produce because there was only three of us at the time. There was Joe Randazzo, who was our executive producer and on-camera guy, if you will, and he had about $250,000 that allowed us to embark on about a four-month documentary shoot where we got to travel all around the world. We went to New York, we went to Canada, we went to England, we went to France, we went to Switzerland, we went to Italy. We were in England in May of 1990 when the crop circles were actually being formed, like right in front of us. We ultrasounded the Dulce Mesa in 1989, in December of 1989, and actually physically proved for the first time that the UFO abductees were right, that there was, in fact, an underground base or facility underneath the Dulce Mesa. Whether or not they were doing the kind of genetic experimentation that these abductees had claimed, we weren't sure. We actually had some footage that people claimed was taken from inside the mesa. But, I mean, I had the advantage at that time of putting together and compiling about 600 hours of videotape of scientists, abductees, researchers. Anybody had a dog that barked at a UFO, we went out and talked to them, which then led to our interview with Bob Lazar, who was a scientist at Area 51, who then said, well, you know, don't believe what I have to say. Just go out, stand by this road, Highway 375, 130 miles north of Vegas, and just go out on a Wednesday night about sunset, and you'll see a UFO. So it took me about a year to get there in February of 1991, and I took a friend of mine from the LA Times, and myself and actually she was in another car, but myself and another buddy of mine literally had a disc-shaped craft almost hit our car. I mean, just stand right in front of us in the road, do this kind of weird, funky dance, and then just kind of, you know, lope off into the desert where we jumped out of our cars and gave chase to this thing. And
wow.
And then after that, that led to sightings, and I was involved in, actually, Linda Moulton Howe pitched sightings to Fox, and then I was one of the producers on the Area 51 piece, part of the segment producers on that, and set up this whole trip for them to go out to 51. In that period of time, I'd found a hilltop that looked down on the base. So myself and a group of friends were the first people to actually film and videotape the base for the first time, and we actually filmed this kind of mysterious plane landing at the base, not a UFO, as some people say. As a matter of fact, we disproved the theorem that this UFO would come in at 4:50 a.m. and Old Faithful, as they called it. But at the same time, I can also say that this craft that was actually landing at 51. Sometimes at 4:50 a.m. there was a disc that did all kinds of crazy things that we filmed. Once again, there's all this weird sleight of hand being done by the military so they could then say, well, that's not a UFO. These people are idiots. That's just an airplane. Like, we don't know what airplanes look like. So, but it allowed me kind of a width and breadth of this information that was really stunning, because I was getting paid to go research it. And then this led to my involvement with Area 51. I mean, I can't even tell you. First off, it's Area 51. We got on the front page of the LA Times. It was just a local story in Vegas until I took the Times out there. It made the front page of the Times. And then it got picked up by Denver. Then it got picked up by the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. And it becomes, obviously, this global phenomenon. I took Dean Devlin out there, who later did the movie Independence Day. We took a bunch of the writers from The Simpsons, which I thought was very fun. They were all into it, so we rented a big van and took all the Simpsons guys out there. I believe Conan O'Brien was actually the head writer on The Simpsons when we took them out there, so that was
wow.
Gang of fun. And then,
well, let's listen. I got to take a really quick break.
Okay, sure.
We'll take about a 5-minute break, and we'll be back with
okay.
More X Squared Radio and my very excellent guest, Sean David Morton. Don't go away, my friends. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio. You should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. People write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysms. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or a whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPak is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. OvernightPrints.com is your new source for business cards, postcards, and brochures. The best card stock on earth. Easy-to-use online ordering tools and overnight delivery available. Click on the OvernightPrints.com banner and don't forget to use the X Squared code for an extra 10% off and free shipping. Come on, these are world-class business cards at your fingertips. Stop waiting for 2 weeks and paying over $100 for second-rate business cards. Get action fast, as low as $9.95 at OvernightPrints.com. Chances are you own an inkjet printer. They're very cheap to buy, but those supplies can be outrageous. How about clicking on the 123 inkjet banner at X Squared Radio? Very inexpensive supplies, free shipping, and a chance to win a free printer every time you buy. Now, how cool is that? Check out 123 inkjets at x2-radio.com. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version.
Welcome back to X Square Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from extreme eastern Kentucky, up against the foothills of the Appalachians. Happy to come to you tonight. My guest tonight is Sean David Morton, and we're going to get back with him in just a minute. I want to make sure you know the phone lines are open, toll-free in the U.S., 877-876-5227. In Canada, toll-free, 888-815-9756. And anywhere else on the planet or off the planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 530-876-3222. I also wanted to make sure that you knew that Volume 3 of The Ark of Millions of Years went to the publishers this week. It's called Unlocking the Secret. If you've read the book, The Secret, or you own the video, The Secret, you'll realize that there are a few chapters missing from that book. Don't quite have all the tools you need to work the law of attraction. You'll need this book, Unlocking the Secret, to be able to get the rest of the way. That should be out on the shelves at your local Barnes & Noble. You'll be able to get it online at Barnes & Noble or Amazon. And, of course, first at our online store at x2-radio.com. I also wanted to give you an update on the Inner Earth Expedition. You know that the video of Part 1 is available at Amazon and also at our website at x2-radio.com. It's a 31-minute, very intense video. We call it Hollow Earth for Dummies, I guess. It also has exclusive footage. Starts on Mount Shasta on location and goes to Tibet, and you will see footage on this that you will find nowhere else on Earth. That is also available. In January, we are going to bring you part two of that from a distant country. Hopefully it's going to be in HD, so it'll be much higher quality, and we'll add part two to that documentary series. And my guest tonight is Sean David Morton. He almost doesn't need any introduction. He's sort of the General Motors of the UFO industry, at least as far as bringing that information to the public, and we're grateful to have him on the program tonight. Welcome back, Sean.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Okay, good, good.
This hour, what I'd like to do is kind of leave that genre a little bit, and let's talk about the possibility of an event and maybe the future surrounding it. We like to call it Global First Contact here at X Squared Radio. I don't think there's any doubt that UFOs have been visiting this planet a long time, and that maybe, most likely, those are involved with off-world civilizations. They may even be other dimensional civilizations. But the sightings, and I had Stanton Friedman on the program a couple of months ago, and I told him, you know, Stanton, I think I've got a couple of pictures you might be interested in. He said, pictures aren't any good anymore. The blurry pictures, the clear pictures, they mean nothing. We need hard evidence. We need a bolt. We need an engine or a bone,
yeah,
or something.
Isn't that nice of Stan to simply dismiss everyone else but himself?
Yeah. Well, the idea.
I gotta love his beard, though. I gotta love that. It looks like he escaped from a farm in Intercourse, Pennsylvania, somewhere. Don't you think?
East Tennessee.
Somewhere in Amish country. Somewhere.
Yeah, I think East Tennessee fits it really well.
Ah, yes. Okay.
Hasn't seen a razor around the edges in a while.
Yeah,
kind of growing
old
wild.
Grandpa Jebediah out there.
Well, you know, far be it from me to make fun of his attire or how he looks. I mean, I have a face for radio, so I don't really.
Oh, you are a stunningly handsome man. Don't even, you're beating off the chicks with a stick. You can't even wave a dead cat in my face. You're a manly man in a manly way with a manly laugh.
Well, so anyway,
don't let old Brooksy fool you out there, kids. He's a handsome, dashing guy. He's the Johnny Depp of radio, whatever.
Well, if you want to verify the statements one way or the other, you'll have to pick up the DVD of the Inner Earth Expedition and see for yourself.
All right.
Even though I have my Indiana Jones hat on and my sunglasses, you should still be able to tell.
Like I said, a very dashing guy. So,
well,
so you want a prediction about when they're going to land on the White House lawn? Is that what you want to know?
Well, I don't know if they'll do that. I mean, there's no intelligent life there. But, you know, they're going to have to land in an Independence Day fashion. You know, we're talking a 5-mile diameter craft hovering over L.A. with Fox News and CNN.
Well, we already had one 22 miles across floating over Phoenix, and it didn't even make national news until I came along in January of the next year and put it up on hard copy.
And it was funny how many people claimed to be involved in that. And we had everybody from Stephen Greer to,
in the Phoenix Lights case?
Yeah.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Everybody claims to be involved in that, and they've all got books, and they're all the ones that broke the story, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the only reason I got it on hard copy when I did and first covered the Phoenix Lights, which was the first national exposure to this. I'm sorry, it was mentioned for 16 seconds by Dan Rather, who simply said, somebody thought they saw a big UFO over Phoenix, but it turned out to be a bunch of flares from a military exercise. Very few people report on the fact that the Phoenix Lights actually returned in January of 1998, and these huge triangles began flying over Phoenix. And the only reason I was able to weasel a ticket for a film crew to actually get out there and report on it is because I also promised them a couple of stories out of Sedona that basically I said I could get them a threefer, that I could actually get the Phoenix Lights, I could get a thing on Sedona, America's Mysterious Mecca, and a story on a friend of mine, Cynthia Hart, as a American prophetess. And I think I could pick up like the Hawaiian tanning Tropic Girls on the way back through Vegas. So that was the that's why
who were in
and that's
need
and that's when hard copy
oil
was
boys.
The hard copy was the first national TV show when I went out there and the stuff that I found because we only did a 6-minute piece on it we handed to Bert Kearns, who was a former exec producer at Hard Copy and later went on to exec produce Strange Universe. His wife Allison Holloway. Myself and my director were at a party, and we were just talking to her about what we'd found out in Phoenix, and we gave her the rest of the information that we had, and she actually did an hour-long special on UPN, what is now the CW network, called Danger in Our Skies, that had a lot to do with all the other information that we'd gathered on the Phoenix Lights that, you know, at that time. And I know there's people that claim there's one woman out there now saying she was like the first one talking about it who would not appear on camera when we interviewed her. She was Dr. X, and I don't even know what her name is now, but she's written this book on the Phoenix Lights, and again, she wouldn't appear on camera for us, so she was in the dark. Now, 10 years later, in the 10-year anniversary of the Phoenix Lights, all these people are crawling out of the woodwork claiming that they were the first ones. And actually,
Governor recanted his denial.
Who did?
Recently. Even the governor of Phoenix recanted his denial that he didn't see anything, and he just recanted that like this year.
Right. Well, Fife Symington appeared. Well, he also went to jail too in the meantime. But he appeared on. He actually again, this was just a local story out of Phoenix. This was just a kind of a local joke until some national media attention was actually turned on it when Symington interrupted all the news feeds on the networks and came on noon and said, you know, we found the perpetrator of this, and he dressed up one of his little office monkeys as an alien. And he had the deputy sheriffs bring him out in handcuffs and the whole thing dressed up like an alien. It was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever seen. Anyway, to this day, we have no idea really what it was. There's a lot of really more frightening aspects that have to do with the military involvement of this. And there's a couple of things that it could be. It could be a gigantic, they have military transports that are very, very large that they call hulas. They're sort of like hard-shelled Zeppelins that are actually used to transport troops and tanks and guns and things like that. There's another aspect of this too that this was probably the scariest part that I found, is that not only were the Phoenix Lights attached to a much larger craft, but the lights themselves also were accompanied by a series of boomerang shaped, I guess you would call them alpha. It's always unusual to me the symbology of it, because here you have those ships in 1997, which looked almost exactly like the ships that you saw in Independence Day, and the main ship was shaped like a giant omega. It was kind of a disc with two big fins off the back of it that then had a series of either lights or craft or something along the front nose of it that would actually pop off the main ship and then move around and then come back and dock with the main object. And then you had these boomerangs, with a wingspan of about, I guess, 300 feet from the tips of them. There were two interviews that we did just in brief, because I think this is interesting and it doesn't really get a lot of play. The two interviews that we did that we thought were the most interesting, and let me make that three, because one of the interviews we couldn't get. I spoke to a lady colonel at the National Guard station who I spoke to on the phone, and I was trying to get an interview with her, who was trying to tell me that these were flares that were being released as part of an exercise. And I said, well, really? Well, what time did this exercise happen? And she said, well, the exercise happened around 10:37 or something like that. And I said, and where did you drop them? And she said, well, it was over the Goldwater Range, which is the other side of the Australian Mountains. And, you know, and I said, I have film and videotape of these supposed flares that you're admitting to being dropped directly in the corridor to the Sky Harbor International Airport. And I've also got video of these flares actually being dropped at somewhere around 8:30 or so. So if you're not telling me the truth, if you're telling me the truth about flares, and you're telling me where they've been dropped, and you're interfering with civilian air traffic, then somebody's going to jail. And she hung up the phone on me. And then we tried to go over there, and we busted in the front door of the National Guard place, and they sent guys with guns in our faces to actually throw us into the street. So that was the interesting part, that the supposed flare story completely collapsed under any sort of scrutiny whatsoever. The second one was a guy by the name of Captain Richard Curtis, who was a war veteran from the Vietnam War. He won the Bronze and Silver Star. And this guy climbed up on top of his apartment building and actually filmed the main craft from directly underneath it, not just blinky lights, not just something from way up in the mountains, none of this nonsense. He actually filmed the bottom of the ship with his video camera. He then called Francis Barwood, who was the city councilwoman, because she'd received about 20,000 phone calls from local residents about this event.
Oh my God.
Saying, shouldn't we look into this? And the film was very funny, because people just looked at her askance and just said, yeah, right, let's just move on. And she was just trying to field some of the things from her constituents. So this Captain Curtis called her on the phone and said, look, I kind of heard about the story on the news, and I have this film. Would you like it? And she said, sure, I would love it, but it has to be delivered in a certain way. Could you please walk it into the office, write this code on the front of it, et cetera, so that I can, so that you can deliver it here. So he was getting ready to do this. He lives in a very bad part of Phoenix. He's kind of, he's a poor old veteran, if you will, and he had to walk about six blocks in the heat to City Hall, and he had this whole thing put together with a package for the numbers, and suddenly there's a knock on his door, and there's two guys that he said looked like twins with kind of, with the black suits and kind of mo haircuts with these black sunglasses, kind of yellowish, he said, almost like pasty skin, who said, are you Captain Richard Curtis, served in Vietnam from da-da-da-da-da, his serial number, blah, 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 blah. And he said, well, yeah, that's me. And they said, well, we're here from Francis Barwood's office to pick up this tape that you're talking about.
Uh-oh.
And they said, do you have you made copies of the tape? No. Have you showed the tape to anybody? No. Oh, good. Well, we'll take it now. And he said, like robots, they stuck their hand out and they turned like on their heel and kind of marched out of the place. Now, this story was then confirmed because we then interviewed a Catholic Monsignor who had actually been the Monsignor of the Phoenix Parish for something like 26 years. Antonio Giglio, I believe, if my memory serves, was his name. Guy was kind of a Charles Nelson Reilly kind of character, very funny. And he was coming in to the complex to visit his friend Captain Curtis when he saw these two very odd men marching out of the compound with this package. Thinking that someone was in trouble in the compound, he followed them out to the parking lot where he says they got into a jet black 1955 Buick Roadmaster with blacked out windows, and he said he did not hear the car start, he did not hear an engine, nor did he see the wheels move, and this thing just glided out of the parking lot and out into the street.
Oh,
and we interviewed him. We've got a Catholic priest and a former war veteran who were talking about how, for the first time in many, many years, we had what we thought was a legitimate Men in Black type story of people who were actually covering up the tracks of anybody that had anything that was incontrovertible evidence that was not just lights taken from a long ways away. So that, and then the most the scariest part of the story for me was, and Allison Holloway later went back and interviewed these folks, but we found two airline pilots who worked for, I think, United and Southwest, and they and their wives were actually off on a camping trip, and they were actually driving back into Phoenix, I believe, along the 10 freeway. And they claimed they pulled off the road, and that for a good 30 minutes or so, they sat and they watched two of these huge boomerang wing craft, and they said they looked like black boomerangs, and they had one had a red light in the nose, another one had a blue light in the nose, and then as you went back in the craft, there were lights actually kind of equidistant in sections along the craft, and these two objects were floating over a mesa where the blue beam and the red beam were coming together, and as they were floating over this mesa, they saw what they claimed to be holographic type images of the baby Jesus, of an angel holding a flaming sword, of what they said looked like kind of like the face of God, a guy with an old beard, various types of religious icons that were actually being projected on this mountaintop by these two aircraft.
Wow.
And they said these things were just kind of morphing back and forth, and they looked very, very real, but they were however many feet high, you know, 60 to 100 feet high or so, because they were at quite a distance from the mesa where they could see them. And they said after about 30 minutes, the things just shut off, and then the two aircraft moved away in formation. That, to me, was probably the scariest part of this whole thing, because why would extraterrestrials that didn't have a connection with the military be actually projecting holographic images of religious icons?
Yes.
Unless they were to be used to possibly control a population, unless they were to be used as part of, say, I don't know, if you were in a war with Iraq or Iran, you could project maybe the Prophet Muhammad on a mountaintop that says, you know, stop this, the Americans are right, you must surrender, or something like that. I just thought it was, there was so much kind of military skullduggery that was going on around these craft. There were so many interesting things going on as to, if it was extraterrestrial, why would it be covered up not only by the military but by the National Guard? Why would they not talk to us? Why do you have holographic images being projected out of two of these things? I mean,
well, it does seem as though there are at least three aspects to this. One is Earth-based, government-manipulated lookalikes to try to get people either energized to, hey, we need to beef up the military budget because we're being invaded from outer space kind of thing, or to even throw up disinformation smoke screens to cover up military vehicles that may in fact be able to make a left-hand turn at 10,000 miles an hour.
Right.
Or you really do have off-worlders, and if we do have off-worlders, they're probably not all from one source, nor do they all have one motivation. There may be good guys and bad guys, so to speak. And maybe, you know, the bad guys are here, and they're trying to sort of get us ready to defend the world against the good guys that are coming to throw them off. I mean, these are all of the scenarios that have been put forth on this program. You just can't number them all, but...
Let me just quote. I mean, the Book of Revelation does talk about how when supposedly Jesus and the angelic horde return, that they all come invading from outer space, and that they supposedly come down in the Valley of Megiddo and whatever else, and eventually have, it's an invasion from outer space when you actually look at it. And if you look at it from the Native American point of view, they talk about an extraterrestrial invasion of the Sky Brothers. Of course, to the American Indian point of view, our version of archangels and our saints and our archangels are actually kind of demons to the Native Americans, since they were responsible for virtually wiping out their entire race here. And it's sort of like one culture's Christ is another culture's Antichrist, as they say.
Well, sure. But we had one of the Yezidis prophets on here the other day.
One of the what? I'm sorry?
Yezidis. It's one of the world's oldest religions, and they worship the peacock angel, which
the angel with a thousand eyes and all that.
Right, right. And the Muslims are trying to wipe them out because they believe the peacock angel to be the devil.
Is the devil, yeah. Like I said, one version is Messiah, another version is anti-Messiah. I'm just kind of curious in this because I don't know. There's people that talk about Project Blue Beam, and that Blue Beam is supposedly a fake return of Christ or a fake rapture, and that's how they gain control of the earth. The government now is actually training preachers in the various churches that when everything starts to come down, I mean, really quick. I mean, we're running out of time. We've got the current administration hell bent on starting World War III. Whether you believe that or not, it's a fact. It's what's happening behind the scenes, and there are people trying to stop it desperately. What I call the true militia, the true Indians fighting against the cowboys, if you will. And so far, they've managed to stop the various machinations of the administration so far. So there are fantastic Americans in all branches of the military and all branches of the higher ups that really know what's coming down and understand that Armageddon is on its way. And let me finish my thought about the whole extraterrestrial thing. Again, here's been my challenge with this, Brooks. Having interviewed, I can't even tell you. Getting paid to do this when I as a producer, as a writer, as a director for the UFO Contactees series, for Sightings, for Unsolved Mysteries, for Geraldo Rivera's Not Gonna Be Told, for Strange Universe. Which you know, I was one of the original creator producers on with Bill Siegel, who was the head of the network, putting this on, and that show ran for about 2.5 years or so. You know, all I can tell you, you know, I was in at the very beginning of the alien autopsy stuff. I was in on the alien interview, which became, you know, rather famous or infamous. It gets to the point where, once again, it's luminous weeds that you ultimately run into a wall that's filled with these Zen cones. It's an enigma wrapped in a riddle that's cooked up in a mystic pie, if you will. And the challenge is that you try to interview the contactees and abductees who you think have been to the other side of that wall, and whose voices are crying in the wilderness from that wall, to try to make some sense out of any of this. And the real challenge is, and I can understand where people like John Lear are coming from, I can understand where people like Bill Cooper maybe came from before he completely lost his mind, I can understand where a lot of these people are coming from, Jacques Vallée, that literally the more you know, the less you know, because there doesn't seem to be a unified field here. There doesn't seem to be a core synthesis to any of this. I mean, because I've interviewed people in Italy. We went all up and down Italy. We went to Genoa. We went to Rome. We went. Then we went into Spain. We interviewed Dr. Anthony Ribera there and a bunch of scientists who are in contact with these. They believe we're extraterrestrials posing as scientists on Earth. We interviewed Billy Meyer in Switzerland. He's got his whole version where he thinks everybody else is a fake, and you know, everybody else that's ever seen a UFO is lying. And it's just, and so you see all the sniping going on between all these people, and yet there's no cosmology. There's no, I mean, Billy Meyer hates Fred Bell, and this person hates that person. These people hate the other people. So it ultimately becomes about, it's almost like a religion where you've got the Jews hate the Muslims, and the Scientologists hate the Germans, and it goes on and on and on and on and on. And the real weird part to this is, and in some cases, they're talking about how they're all benevolent and they're all very nice, and the universe is a very wonderful place, and they're just waiting for us to evolve. On the other hand, you get people that talk about the Alpha Draconians, and they're really evil, and they run certain sections of the government, and the Greys are working with the military, and again, it is, and yet you have some races that believe the Jesus mythology is completely true. Others say that they created him and that he's a clone, and it just, you see where I'm going at with this?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There is no, you get pieces of the puzzle, and you see what's going on, and then you have to sort of fit that into, well, how long have we really had this technology, and is there a possibility that when you've seen what the military has, and you understand that we have a civilian level of technology, which is basically crap, which is all designed to break once the warranty expires. Matter of fact, the day after the warranty expires, it's designed to break.
Right.
You then have the military level of technology, which I've seen with my own eyes, because I've seen a shuttle about, 1,600 feet long or so, come in from space and cause a series of massive, what they called skyquakes in Southern California. And myself and a friend of mine, John Hadley, who was murdered a few years later, saw this thing land at 51. We saw the saucers with our own eyes. We filmed them. We photographed them. We had a unique point in time and space where we were begging the media to come out there. We were begging people with the cameras and we were begging the Larry Kings and the Montel Williamses and all these people. We said, look, this is happening now. Come out on a Wednesday night. Come out there with us. And nobody came. And in late 92, the early part of 1993, that's when it's like the minute they moved everything to Utah or Area 6413 or moved it someplace else, the gate went up. It was Ollie Ollie Oxen Free. You had Larry King out at Area 51 talking about all this. You had these slandering, smearing, hater scum like Glenn Campbell out there, not the rock music singer, you know, out there calling everybody else liars and everybody else names. You know, they asked me to go out there, and I was like, look, I've been begging you guys to come out here for the last 2 years to look at this stuff. There's nothing left, and all you guys are doing is jumping up and down in a barn where the cows have already split. You know, and you're all going to call us all liars and fools, and then it's all just a bunch of airplanes because they just ignored us up until something happened, and so you can see the frustration with this. You know, then you have the Stuart Browns and the people in Popular Science and these boneheads who obviously have some kind of government agenda, you know, who are just all saying, well, this is ramjets and scramjets and advanced plutonium pulse drives, blah blah blah, and there's nothing out here like this, even though you've got photos and video, which they won't look at. So you obviously see the tip of the iceberg of what the cover-up is. And again, there seems to be a level of technology. The military level is about 10 or 15 years ahead of what anything you know. They were flying the SR-71 Blackbird somewhere in the early 1960s, between 60 and like 64. They declassified it in 78, and then they retired the whole program like a year later. So you figure it's about a 15 to 20-year lag. But there is a level of technology above that, Brooks, that is nightmarish, that seems to belong to some kind of mother corporation, which is the only way that I can describe it, that set up entire countries like anybody else would set up burger franchises, that instead of Jack in the Box or McDonald's or Taco Bell, you know, they set up Germany and Russia and France and Spain and the United States. You know, Bill Gates, the richest man in the world about 2 or 3 years ago, finally, as the richest man in the world, finally got invited to the Bilderberger Conference, which is the real richest people in the world, about 600 of them or so, only to walk into that all cocky, saying, you know, well, I'm the richest guy in the world, only to realize he just owns a couple of dopey companies. These people own countries.
Yeah, exactly.
And Bill Gates was never invited back because I think it blew his mind the kind of power these people actually wield, and that when they get together in total secret, because they control the media, they control all the outlets of communication.
Except this one.
Well, except this one, yeah. I mean, but remember, the parasite, while it's sucking your blood at your jugular vein, always has to be positioned somewhere near your ear to let you know how good it is for you that it's sucking your blood. You know, they have to let you know how good the media is, and how good the government is, and how good the police state is. And, you know, so when you analyze all this stuff from all these different angles, I mean, let me give you one other theory here. There is another theory that, let's say, there has been a cabal of scientists or individuals that have never lost the technological advance for, say, the last 500 years. And these technical scientific cabals, which began to be revealed in the beginning of the 20th century, the morning of the magicians, if you will, there are people who have a very interesting argument that the Tunguska meteor was not a meteor whatsoever, but the first above-ground test of an atomic weapon back in 1908, I think, is when Tunguska was, I think.
Wow.
But, I mean, look at it that way. If you look at it that way, and you look at it where Da Vinci's inventing helicopters and airplanes in the 16th century, and then you have people like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and even George Orwell, all of whom, by the way, were Fabian socialists. And the Fabian socialists are directly connected in with the communists, and the communists are directly connected into the League of Just Men, directly connected into Adam Weishaupt's Bavarian Illuminati. The Bavarian Illuminati is directly connected to a lot of these, what we call the Bilderbergers today. That is not the name of them. That's the outer name they use for the uninitiated, simply because it's the name of the hotel that they used in Germany when they first met in 1954. The inner core group is actually called the Incunabula. And I know that sounds kind of funny, but it's actually a Latin term, which means a nest of serpents, or more specifically, like a clutch of serpents' eggs. And it is one of the terms that Jesus used for his enemies, where he said to the Pharisees, "Thou whited sepulchres, thou nest of serpents," when he talked about the hypocrisy of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So it's so the Incunabula and their ilk, these little vipers that they've set forth on the world, when they get together every year, the valuable work that's being done by people like Jim Tucker, who writes for American Free Press, or guys like Alex Jones, who has his who has this kind of crazy top of your lungs sort of radio show. You know, these are the people that are really out there trying to defend our freedom. From my standpoint, I pay very close attention to what these people are saying, because they ain't just whistling Dixie. When they get together and they tell you they're going to collapse the subprime lending market like they did last year, you better pay attention, because that's exactly what they're going to do, because they're the ones that actually are in the position to be able to pull all the levers to make things like that happen. When they tell you that they're going to invade Iraq, when they tell you that the Iranian thing is coming, I mean, they make all these statements about how they want the world to run, and then they send their sniveling sycophants, the George Bush seniors and the George Bush juniors and the Dick Cheneys out there.
The mere presidents of countries.
Yeah, you know, presidents, popes, prime ministers, if you will, who are nothing more than their lackeys or shills. I mean, it's just, you know, these guys are running the world. The only good news that I have about this is that they're not doing it very well. There's a war going on behind the scenes between the Bush-Clinton-Rockefeller cartel and the Rothschild-Warburg, I guess you could call it royal moneyed sect, if you will, of the Europeans. I mean, and a lot of this war and this fissure is happening not really over the plan of ruling the world, but who's basically going to have the bigger cut of the pie once they turn the entire planet into this big plantation. Bush wanted to go into Iraq. The Bilderberger said, okay, but only to remove Saddam. And, of course, Bush didn't do that. He blew Iraq to smithereens so he could give the whole country over to his buddy Dick Cheney and Halliburton and make all kinds of money. Bush wants to go in and basically nuke Iran. The Bilderberger are saying absolutely not. You're going to tip over the apple cart here. Of interest, Vladimir Putin. And I can't believe this is happening, but the Russians now are probably some of the biggest agents for peace on the planet, because Vladimir Putin is the one saying that that hands off Iran. He paid off all of his debt as of June 1st, which means he kicked out the International Monetary Fund. He kicked Chase Manhattan Bank and David Rockefeller out of Russia. He's actually talking about backing the Russian ruble with gold, and he's warned on numerous occasions that if Bush nukes Iran, that they've got a war with Russia, and that's the only thing that's been keeping a lot of this in check recently. And this is what, and I've been talking about this for months. It's just now becoming public knowledge. It is very interesting, and this is the one thing I really wanted to get out of the show, is that October 14th in, gosh, what's today?
Today's the 16th.
Is it today the 16th? All right, well, as of a couple of days ago, they actually started running a war game called Operation Vigilant Shield. And Vigilant Shield should be running as we speak. I haven't heard anything about what's been going on with it, but Vigilant Shield was supposed to run from the 14th to about October 25th or so.
I'm sorry, again, today is the 14th. It's
the 14th.
Started
okay.
Today.
So as of, and today's Sunday, so I would think as of tomorrow morning, Vigilant Shield, it probably starts sometime tonight, tomorrow morning Vigilant Shield starts. And this is an announced exercise by the military. I was trying to warn people about an exercise called Operation Solid Curtain Citadel Shield that was actually happening between September 17th and about September 25th. And what they were doing is that this was a dry run as to what the military response would be if radiological disbursement devices were exploded over Portland, Oregon, Phoenix, Arizona, and Guam.
Oh, is this why in Oregon right now, specifically in Portland, there are a lot of these teams running around with these mock emergency preparedness
yeah,
groups.
Yeah, got it, brother.
They started
setting them up
on
September 17th, actually, as phase one of Solid Curtain Citadel Shield.
Uh-huh.
Phase two is Vigilant Shield, which is running now, or should be running as of tomorrow. Now, when I got this information, I called some of my White House guys and some of my ambassadorial guys inside the UN, and I mean, these people were freaking out, because the minute the United States starts running what we call a false flag operation, every country in the world, and I don't know if I'm offending anybody's sensibilities when I say this, but every country in the world, with the exception of the ignorant American people and apparently Fox News and, you know, the Sean Hannitys and Michael Savages and Rush Limbaughs on the planet, these pumpkin heads, who are basically doing nothing but tell you how the weather is every day up the president's butt. These guys, in essence, Everybody on the planet knows that 9/11 was an inside job. Everybody on the planet knows that 9/11 was a terror operation conducted by black ops within the United States government, the military, and the Israeli Mossad, and that these were buildings that needed to be demolitioned anyway. These were buildings that were going to be torn down because of all the asbestos that was put in them. This was the Silverstein Company that was going bankrupt with these buildings, so it was maximum terror for the minimum amount of damage. They demoed the buildings because the demolition charges were placed in there as part of the retrofit on the buildings after the truck bombing or car bombing of the World Trade Centers back in 93, I think it was.
Right.
And what most people don't realize is that the person who oversaw the retrofit of the buildings, who was actually head of security for Dulles International Airport, United Airlines, and the World Trade Center from 1992 to 2000, was a character by the name of Marvin Pierce Bush, who happens to be George Bush's youngest brother.
Wow.
Yeah, nobody seems to mention that part. So the rest of this that goes down, if you understand that the four horsemen of the apocalypse here, G.W., Jeb, Marvin Pierce, and Neil, the Silverado guy, Marvin Pierce, the security guy for the World Trade Center, Jeb, the governor of Florida, and G.W., the president of the United States, once again, these four horsemen of the apocalypse, that all of this is coming down, in essence, as part of a global plan. And what they did is when they ran Solid Curtain Citadel Shield from September 17th to about the 25th or so, there was all this weird stuff that was coming across my desk. I had a kid in one of my seminars in Mount Shasta whose father was a general, I believe, for STRATCOM, and he said, look, my dad's called me and told me to have a bag by my door and to be ready to get the heck out of Dodge and vacate, basically evacuate Las Vegas with about 2 hours' notice. That was number one. Number two, the Federal Reserve printed about $7.2 billion and shoved it through the discount window, which meant that they were expecting a run on the banks. The only last two times they did this was right after 9/11 and right before New Year's Eve of 2000, expecting runs on the banks. Number three, there was a person out of Deutsche Bank, Germany, that on the somewhere in mid-September took a $4.5 billion put out on the U.S. stock market and in essence was betting that you would see a 40 to 50% drop in the markets within about the next 30 days. Now, that didn't happen, which is kind of interesting because I'm now wondering, was this being used as some sort of market manipulation of some other kind? So I call some of my Washington guys who are just completely losing their minds, who are saying, look, the Russians have lit up. They've sent backfire bombers into NATO airspace. We were at DEFCON 2 for about a 10-day period, where we were just an itchy trigger finger away from, literally, from Armageddon, from World War III. I mean, I had one source within the White House who told me that, look, man, this is as close as we're ever going to come to Armageddon. You know, drink some wine and kiss your wife because, you know, we're all going bye-bye. And everything was lighting up across the board. Well, the minute the United States starts running a false flag, the U.S. and Britain, the last two false flag operations we ran, the British was 7706, which was the train bombings, and the other false flag just so happened to coincide with the terrorist attacks of 9/11. Now, Scotland Yard caught a bunch of British agents with backpack bombs in their cars, dragged them into Scotland Yard, and these guys flashed MI6 military intelligence badges and had to be let go because saying, oh, well, we're just running an exercise, mate. Not our fault. The terrorists figured it out, and they started bombing trains just by coincidence the same day that we were planning on pulling off mock bombings of trains. And the same thing happened with 9/11. There was a reason why Cheney was at NORAD and why the claims that they made that there was no U.S. air support to defend the buildings. They were claiming that, oh, we were running an exercise that day. So the minute the United States starts running an exercise, like tomorrow, like they ran back in September, the whole rest of the world goes on alert because they believe that these black ops military intelligence guys are so crazy that they're going to nuke a city inside the United States in order to get the war with Iran that they want.
But
and
all this
will
seems
actually
to be happening.
Thing.
All this is happening up in the Northwest, in Seattle and Portland.
I haven't heard anything about Seattle, but I heard what happened was in Portland is a friend of mine's a medical examiner up there. His mother's a nurse, and I get the call from them that they've actually got these triage trailers that they've placed all around the city of Portland. And
well, they did the same thing in Charlotte 2 years ago. And then they declared that Charlotte was one of the best prepared. Emergency preparedness wise, one of the best prepared cities
Correct.
On the East Coast. But
in 2005.
Nothing happened.
But they kept this a big secret, actually. Now, the weird part about this is that now that dry run, Solid Curtain Citadel Shield specifically, has now been turned into a white paper, which will probably hit the president's desk at the end of this month, which will then act as a playbook for either an operation they're planning on pulling out, whatever they're going to do. And this is the one last thing, the one last piece of this puzzle, is that when the B-52 loaded with six, not five, as the media reported, but six variable kiloton yield armed nuclear cruise missiles left Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota and wound up in Barksdale, Louisiana, there were about a dozen people that were involved in exposing that information, specifically military people, who said, look, we're doing this because these nuclear weapons are on their way to the Middle East. The next time you see these things, they'll be blowing up Iran, and we're trying to stop Armageddon here. This is an exact quote from them. All 12 of these people, by the way, just in the last 45 days, every single one of them is dead.
Wow.
And you can look it up, folks. If I'm lying, I'm dying. Every single person that was directly related to exposing that story about the supposed accidental transport. And here's the thing, is the media reported on five of these missiles. There were six, and I don't exactly know where the sixth one went. And when I say variable kilotonnage, these were active, live, armed cruise missiles that could be set to a Hiroshima, Nagasaki-type blast to the high end of the scale, which is probably officially holy crap. I mean, if this thing had crashed, you could have actually split the United States open with the kilotonnage that's going on in these weapons. And now, as far as I know, two of them have been decommissioned, but the other four of them have been placed on B-52s and are basically ready to go to Iran at a moment's notice. And let me tell you all the other weird things that are going on right now. Last week, Turkey, completely under the radar and not reported really in the U.S. press, but Turkey started bombing northern Iraq, started bombing positions in Kurdistan, or started bombing the Kurds in the northern part of Iraq, and this week the Turks are going to invade the northern part of Iraq.
We kind of knew that was going to happen, because as soon as the Kurds were given any kind of independence at all, we knew it was going to make the Turks mad.
But it's happening this week. Again, and I've been telling you that this vigilant shield is going down this week, so the Turks are invading to the north. That means they'll be along the border of Syria and Iraq. Here's the big thing. They've got something in the Bekaa Valley on the border of Iraq and Syria that possibly might be nuclear weapons. Maybe. There's four of them that were actually smuggled out of Iraq. Two of them we think work, and they've been hidden somewhere in the Bekaa Valley. So strikes into that area are what is key and tantamount. The whole thing that's really stopped this whole deal from happening before now, and just in brief, the progression of it was, we had combat carrier groups sitting in the Persian Gulf ready to go in March of 2006. And what happened was is that the generals in the Pentagon, specifically General Peter Pace, who was the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that time, made the call that we're not doing this. They put a report on the president's desk that they said attacking Iran with nuclear weapons means you get the Chinese, you get the Russians involved. This is Armageddon. We cannot fight a war from the Persian Gulf with an open sea navy that is basically nothing more than a puddle. You've got 1,200 miles of coastline that now becomes hostile. You've got oil prices going up to $150 to $200 a barrel. You've got the Iranians able to strike inside Israel, inside the Green Zone in Iraq. They've got nuclear tips for their missiles that they got from the Russians, specifically through the Ukraine. And they said this is suicide. This is national suicide, and this is Armageddon. And Bush's response was, I don't care. Bring it on. And Peter Pace said, we do not have to obey the orders of a commander-in-chief that we consider to be clinically insane. Stand down. And it was Pace that was the one that stopped everything. And this became, and I reported this in my newsletter in March of 2006, and 3 months later, you started hearing about it in the press, known as the General's Revolt, which eventually is what led to the resignation of Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld's still there, by the way. He's still got a staff of 100. He hasn't even moved his office. He's still sitting in the Pentagon running everything behind the scenes. Phase two of this was, there was a burst of communications transmissions on July 3rd of this last year. It was the largest top-secret communications burst that had been picked up since right before Desert Storm. Vladimir Putin is in his airplane going across the Atlantic, going to South America, because the Russians just got the 2014 Winter Olympics, and he was doing something to congratulate something or whatever. He gets this burst. He changes course mid-Atlantic, lands in Washington, D.C. the evening of July 3rd, and the 4th of July, he's at Camp David, eating hot dogs and hamburgers, basically swearing at Bush, saying, if you attack Iran, we're looking at global thermonuclear war. We are not going to get cut out of a piece of the action here. We have major business interests with the Iranians. The Russians are the ones that are actually building all of the nuclear facilities in Iran. They've said, look, we are approved by the International Atomic Energy Commission. We are the ones feeding Iran radioactive isotopes. They are not being given anything
weapons grade.
That is weapons grade. They are maybe 150 to 200 years away from developing anything. Iran has signed the non-nuclear proliferation treaty. By the way, Israel has not. Israel possesses 500 or 600 nuclear weapons, which they're pointing at the rest of the Middle East, which is one of the reasons why everybody in the Middle East is trying to get a nuclear bomb, because they're terrified of the nukes that Israel possesses. So you're seeing the vicious cycle here that is going on. And Putin said, if you blow up Iran, you've got some problems. And, you know, you're going to have to deal with us. And Bush's response to him was, you shouldn't be there anyway, and you got 2 months to get your people out of there. And Putin was just in shock. And now he's gone public with it. And we're going to have to deal with Putin for a long time, because after he gets done being president, he's actually going to become prime minister. So, which means that his party is strong enough now for him to actually basically take over the parliament and become prime minister for the next 20 years if he wants to. He's a hero.
Here's what I know, Sean. I know that you're probably right. My research on 9/11.
I do not want to make the show about 9/11. There's a whole other thing on this.
I know. I just want to lay some groundwork here. I know there are anomalies about it. I know that the Pentagon wasn't hit by an airplane. I know what an airplane crash looks like, and that wasn't one. I also know that 93 didn't crash. It was shot down out of the sky, and debris was spread over 1.5 miles. It wasn't
I'd be really interested in seeing that, because that plane, they claim, vaporized, and the plane that hit the Pentagon liquefied. So I'd be really interested to see the wreckage of that plane.
Exactly.
Because it went into a hole. The official story was that it actually hit a hole and went into a collapsed coal mine.
Oh, that's really funny.
But it hit the ground. That's why you didn't see miles of wreckage. I would have loved to have actually seen the miles of wreckage that people are talking about, because it ain't there.
Well, anyway,
I don't want to get into a debate on that. What I'm telling you now is that we're not just talking about tactical nuclear strikes on Iran. We're talking about high-altitude radiological disbursement devices that are designed to systematically genocide about 4 million people, and that this is what the current administration has planned before this guy gets out of office. And I don't know what else to say. I don't know, and I am not a Hillary Clinton fan. I'm a guy that worked for Reagan in the 1980s, but, you know, I've had to sit back and watch this supposedly Christian conservative president rape the Constitution, rape the country, spend us broke, trick us into a series of wars, and everybody says that he's just stupid.
Well, here's the thing about it. I don't think that we are the only players on this planet. I sincerely believe that there are forces working off-world that are pouring forth energy into this world that many thousands, if not millions, of people are beginning to pick up. And, Sean, it's a very positive, very loving energy that seems to be pouring forth. And I see a lot of enlightenment happening among people. And the thing that I'm seeing is that time after time, these moments of destruction, these turning points where we're supposed to be walking off this precipice and following this eschatological pathway to self-destruction, it's not happening, because time after time, there are key individuals or groups of individuals that are generating light in key places, and they're turning this force. We're meeting it almost point and counterpoint with very positive, very enlightened energy. You and I have been to a lot of conferences. Most recently, you were up at Mount Shasta. These people weren't doom and gloomers. These were people looking for the great enlightenment of this age. We are on the verge of a metamorphosis, our race is, and it's quite possible that there are more advanced races in space, or maybe inside the Earth, that are very interested in that advancement. They want to see it happen. They want to see us walk away from this war. And what I want to cover in the next hour is maybe tap into that high spiritual Sean David Morton that's there, along with your steel trap mind on all of these players that are happening, and see if we can't find a solution in this next hour that will offer hope and maybe inspiration to those people that are listening to this program. All right?
Amen.
So we'll be back after these messages. My guest is Sean David Morton, perhaps one of the most brilliant minds in what I'm going to call exopolitics going on in the world today. Don't go away. Our third hour is going to be fantastic with more of X Squared Radio after this. OvernightPrints.com is your new source for business cards, postcards, and brochures. The best card stock on earth, easy-to-use online ordering tools, and overnight delivery available. Click on the OvernightPrints.com banner, and don't forget to use the X Squared code for an extra 10% off and free shipping. Come on, these are world-class business cards at your fingertips. Stop waiting for 2 weeks and paying over $100 for second-rate business cards. Get action fast, as low as $9.95 at OvernightPrints.com. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Chances are you own an inkjet printer. They're very cheap to buy, but those supplies can be outrageous. How about clicking on the 123 Inkjet banner at X Squared Radio? Very inexpensive supplies, free shipping, and a chance to win a free printer every time you buy. Now, how cool is that? Check out 123 Inkjets at x2-radio.com. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Up in the sky very early in the morning the last couple of days and seen three bright objects in the sky. One of them is Venus, one of them is Saturn, and the other is a very bright body known as Reticulus, forming a nice triangle in the eastern sky. You want to get out tomorrow morning and have a look at those. You'll be able to see them for a few more nights. Also, October 29th, get ready for the comet. Break out your 20-power binoculars and your binocular chair, and you'll get to see one of the rarest events in cosmology out there. Also wanted to let you know that Volume 3 of The Arc of Millions of Years went to the publisher this last week. Should be ready shortly. So please pay a visit to X Squared Radio's online store and check that out. Make sure to get your order in as quick as you can. And they'll all be autographed. It's going to come out about 430 pages. I promise you're going to enjoy it. I think, in my opinion, it's the best of the three. But that's just my opinion. I think you'll really like it. And also, don't forget to pick up that DVD of the Inner Earth Expedition. It would make a great Christmas present for someone. If you like the Discovery Channel, you're really going to like this DVD. Also, this next week or so, I will be taping for one of the episodes of No Experience Necessary, which is a new Discovery Channel program filmed on location and hosted by a Scottish host who's been quite successful in Scotland and will be hosting this new program called No Experience Necessary for the Discovery Channel. We're going to be discussing Hollow Earth Theory, so we're going to have a lot of fun with that. You remember that our Japanese version of this hypothesis documentary won the Genes of Galileo Prize in May of this year. So hopefully we can duplicate that again with the Discovery Channel. My guest tonight is Sean David Morton. He has a website he's going to tell us about a little bit and some of his upcoming events. In this hour, we're going to try to venture into the future a little bit, and we're going to tie maybe what you might consider the spiritual, the off-worldly, the more metaphysical in with the more practical things that you might be seeing on the revolving drive-by media news that you see every day. And maybe what that has to do with human consciousness, maybe what we have to do with the creation and the state of our universe. Maybe we can take a little more responsibility than you think. You may not have to be a member of the Bilderbergers to have an effect. My guest is Sean David Morton. Welcome back, Sean.
Hello.
Yes. Sean, your website, that's Delphi Associates.
Actually, it's just, we made it a lot easier. It's just SeanDavidMorton.com.
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 Okay, we'll have that linked on the website as well.
Okay.
And tomorrow morning when millions of BBS radio listeners...
Millions upon billions.
Well... BBS Radio has about 12 million hits a week, so a lot of them do come to X Squared Radio to listen to the archives.
Fantastic.
There, and they also buy our archives because it's a little bit different mix because it comes from the studio here.
Well, I'd like to say hello to all 12 million of them. Hello, 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 hello.
Yes, yes, and don't forget to each one of you send a dime in as a donation for the expedition.
There you go.
Just a little plug for that. All right, Sean, this hour, what we're going to try to do, you have probably the most unique perspective of any human being on the planet today. You're so well connected into the political community. You have contacts, you know, deep inside, which none of us have. But you also have this high spiritual training and this great metaphysical awareness about you. And what we want to do this hour is trying to bring both of those together to see if our listeners can decipher some kind of solution for themselves out of this, besides going to the bank, getting all their cash out, and building a bunker somewhere in the mountains of Colorado. There has to be another solution, and there is one, I believe. And one of the things that I found in my research is this: it's almost touchable, it's almost tangible, and that is this Christ grid that seems to be almost an alter-dimensional energy network that hooks into the planet, specifically to high mountains. It almost links to it. And it becomes energized when the consciousness of the people rises to the point where we become sentient and aware and caring. and it becomes de-energized when we become three-dimensional and we start charging across the frozen tundra with battle axes in hand. And I think we have a real balance going on in our world today. We have the very enlightened and we have the very asleep. And it appears, at least to this talk show host, that the very asleep are the ones at the wheel right now. So how do we resolve this? What do you see with all of your experience? Lead us.
Well, I wouldn't exactly say that the people at the wheel right now are asleep, because I think that that relieves them of responsibility for what they're doing. I think they know exactly what they're doing. I think that there's been a plan put in place by them to do exactly what it is they're doing. So I don't think I'd let them off the hook. That's just like saying that, oh, well, Bush is just stupid. Oh, he just can't speak the English language. And then you see everything he's managed to accomplish for these dark lords, if you will. Here's the best way to look at it.
Well, do you think all the dark lords are terrestrial, or do you think they might be ancient?
No, I don't know, Brooks. I mean, I can't tell you because I don't know. I haven't had one appear fully blown in front of me. That gets to, once again, philosophy / mythology, if you will, of the UFO community, of where I talk to people who say, some people say all the bad guys are in charge, other people say all the good guys are in charge, and it's an entire enigma / riddle / conundrum. The best way for me to look at it is that usually when you're trying to figure out the future, the best way to do is go back into the past, because it does seem that ancient cultures and civilizations specifically go back to remnants of the Atlantean civilization, which later became Egypt, or also remnants of the Atlantean civilization that became the Mayas and the Incas.
And the Irish.
And the Irish, of course, the Irish.
That's right. Don't forget us.
They knew that as humanity progressed down through the ages, that I don't know if we'd get dumber or not, or whether or not the bad guys would succeed in blocking us off from the true grand nature of who and what we are, a glorious star-spanning species that are here on this planet for a brief period of time until we ascend back to wherever it is we're going to go. My perspective of this is that I always look towards the Great Pyramid of Giza. It's very interesting for me because when I was a kid, I got to actually spend time in Egypt. My dad had a Lebanese business partner, and my stepfather was one of the first Americans to actually start trading in Egypt after Sadat turned from the Soviet bloc and actually turned towards the United States. So I got to be there between 74, 75 or so. I got to go to school there. I've led a lot of trips there. It's kind of my spiritual homeland, if you will. So the Book of Isaiah in Isaiah 19. Says that in the last days that there shall be that in the center and the border of the land of Egypt there shall be a monument and a pillar of remembrance to the Lord thy God. It's interesting that there is only one structure in the world that is at the border and yet at the center of a country, and that is the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid is at the border of Upper and Lower Egypt and yet stands dead center of the entire country of Egypt. A pillar of remembrance usually means a funerary monument, which is, in essence, what the Great Pyramid is. And a pillar of remembrance specifically states that the Great Pyramid is a cosmic warning, a series of fantastic snakes and ladders, and a mountain of sacred geometry that through the mathematics of the pyramid itself actually gives us, or should I say, just through the angles and the passages of moving through the three various angles of the pyramid, actually give us a greater overview of where we're going in the future. And the fantastic thing about the pyramid is that since it started to be discovered in the prophetic light by Rutherford around the turn of the century, and then later Tomlinson, and then Peter Lemasseur, who wrote the book The Great Pyramid Decoded, which was originally printed, I think, in 74 and then was reprinted again in 2000 or so. The reason I go into all that research is because the essence of the Great Pyramid is that it shows that there are, in fact, three paths, and that these three paths have a path of evil, of those who simply don't want to see the light, don't want the light, just continue to steer the ship, so to speak, down into the pit, down into the well of souls, down into complete soul annihilation, if you will. Which actually leads to an area 151 feet below the pyramid, which is a of the Well of Souls there, that there is another path, the Queen's Chamber path, that is kind of enlightened, sort of, and then gets completely involved in the whole materialistic aspect of the world, and they continue to incarnate over and over and over again just because they like stuff and sex and free beer and all the stuff that Earth and the physical body has to offer. And so they get caught in the realm of the material, in what's known as the Queen's Chamber. And then there is a mass of humanity, the children of light, if you will, that are set free by the central messianic figure, who, according to the time code, lives between approximately 2 BC and about 33 AD or so. And whatever this messianic figure does opens the doorway to heaven, the new heaven and the new earth, if you will, leads to a 2,000-year era of the age of the disincarnate enlightened ones, which means disincarnate enlightened means that those, you live a life for 50, 60, 70, 100 years or so, there are seven concourses to the pyramid by which you then study with the ascended masters and the saints and the Buddhas and the Christ and whatever on these other levels. You and your family and friends, so to speak, then recreate a series of situations for you to all reincarnate together about 100 to 150 years apart or so, and that's what the age of Pisces has pretty much been about, this 2,000-year era of our learning on the greater and higher planes and levels and then coming back down to basically work that magic on Earth. 1844, a new age begins. The great step in the pyramid represents that there would be, in a 56-year period, from 1844 until about 1900 or so, that there would be a massive amount of technological enlightenment that on the one hand would lead to heaven on Earth, but on the other hand would lead to hell on Earth as well. And in 56 years, we accomplished more, I think, in that brief period of time technologically than we did in the entire 10 to 12,000-year history of man up before that. In that period of time, we saw the Industrial Revolution, we saw the steam engine, we saw the cotton gin, we saw alternating current, we saw direct current, we saw the automobile, the phonograph, the motion picture machine. All these things occurred within that period of time. And so this upward step of humanity then levels off around 1900, and the time coding of the pyramid then says that the age of the disincarnate enlightened ends somewhere around 1900 to about 1914, and now everybody who has ever lived now has to come back for the final graduation. So the Christians call it the rapture or the resurrection of the quick and the dead, and what the pyramid calls it is universal reincarnation, that it predicts that we would see the population begin to explode, that we'd see it reach about 7 billion or so, that we would see this massive incarnation because everybody has to be here at once for the grand graduation, if you will. It may be why our skies are filling with flying saucers and UFOs, because they may be our relatives from other planes and other dimensions trying to get a good seat at the graduation.
Uh-huh.
And there is a plan here. It is interesting that the descending passage of the pyramid, and this gets into a little bit of what David Icke is saying and maybe where he takes it from, but there's this constant battle between the Lords of Light and Darkness. The Lords of Light seem to be led by Osiris and Isis and Hathor, and the Lords of Darkness seem to be led by the serpent god Set or Seth or Sutekh. 2652 BC is, I believe, when the passage of the downward, it represents the fall of man, represents where the brain in our head separates the left and the right, the male and female actually separate, the reptilians, literally the serpents in the garden, separate the masculine and the feminine. And it is of interest that the downward path in the pyramid, which represents the fall or the death of man going from a godlike spirit in a realm where we are, in fact, godlike, we can travel through the universe, we can see into the past and the future, and then when we come into the pyramid has five sides representing humanity, representing the earth, representing a individuality, representing a limited perspective. The Book of the Dead is really describing physical life as they knew it, because they saw the afterworld as being the realm of the gods, and when we, in the form of spirit, were far more knowledgeable and powerful, but we had to take on physical forms and physical bodies in order to use the concepts of time and space to be able to play the game. You can't play Monopoly unless you become a top hat or a Scotty dog or a race car or an iron and go around the game board. You buy a ticket to the movie theater, so to speak, which is your contract to agree to sit in the dark and sit in the theater and allow a series of projected shadow play illusions up on the screen, which is pretty much what your life is like. You buy a ticket when you come in, you agree to submit to time and space, your spirit agrees to sit in that darkened room and then project your fantasy life, if you will, up on the screen. It's really no more real than those phantoms in any movie that you're going to watch. It's all tomato sauce blood, it's all fake violence, it's all in the greater perspective of the fact that no one can be killed, in the greater perspective of scientifically that energy cannot be created or destroyed, therefore we are scientifically immortal. In that aspect, you have to look at the progressions, both good and bad, both wars and peace, if you will, as being a matriculation through a much larger cosmic university, of which, again, if the soul shard, if soul stands for survival of universal life, and God stands for generator, operator, destroyer. We generate, operate, and destroy all the circumstances in our existence. We survive, we are the survival of universal life that is the essence of the soul shard, what the Tibetans call the Vajra, the diamond scepter that moves from body to body to body in the 10,000-petaled lotus. The lotus petal can be just brushed against and it withers and dies, but that every strike or every friction that we take in our own lives is then another strike by God upon the diamond of what we are that allows us to greater reflect the light of source. So with this all said, we have these three paths in the pyramid. The downward path of the pyramid is when the North Star at that time, which was Alpha Draconis, also known as Thuban, which is the head of the constellation of the dragon, is somehow responsible. The mythology is that the Alpha Draconians or some kind of reptilian race is somehow responsible for the fall of man, for taking, and I think this is the best way to take a look at it, that we traded knowledge, infinite knowledge and direct access to the Akashic field of all knowledge, and we traded that, which is basically what the right side of our brains, the eastern side of our brains, directly connect into a quantum space where there is no time, there is no space, time is not linear. We think in terms of quantum time and come from a space of all knowing to the cheap kind of whorish substitute of what we call Western science that we would call, quote, understanding, which is in fact a burden because we're in fact standing under something of a great weight only to have it crush us. So that's what I think was the fruit in the garden, that was the knowledge of the fruit of good and evil. But when we descend into the pyramid then we become physical form, and we've got the descending path, which on the descending aspect of it takes one large group of people, and starting about 1900 or so, goes to the edge of a pit in the ground that when the initiate is moving through the pyramid, if he falls into the pit, he in fact dies. That pit, strangely enough, was a water torture area,
right,
where the initiate would sit there and they would block it off and water would run in through it. The edge of the pit is somewhere approximately around the fall of about 2005 or so. And I think it's interesting. Actually, it was more around 2004. I think it's interesting that that's when you had the Sumatran quake, which created a huge tidal wave. You had the challenges in Louisiana, which were all water-related. Everybody's talking about global warming, water-related, water, 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 all these things that have to do with this water torture, if you will, down there in the pit. The bad news is for that group of people is that those who don't fall into the pit, and this is plus minus 3 years, so if you give it 2004, plus minus 5, 6, 7, right up to about where we're at now, there are those who then turn right away from the pit. But then there's what's called the River of Fire, and there seems to be some kind of cosmic event that strikes the planet between 2012 and 2014, of which, and I'm sure you've been there, Brooke, so you've seen it, this rift, if you will, it's carved out of the far wall, and it's a trough is what it is, that then has these like seven carbuncles on it that look like a spine. And the River of Fire represents some cosmic event that seems to have something to do with heat or the sun or some kind of solar flare or what have you,
that
strikes the planet between 2012 and 2014. And everybody that escapes that finally just crawls in this hole at the other side and goes another 50 years and is completely dissolved. It is of interest that you have the Alpha Draconians that are directly related to all the downward paths of man, but all the upward hash marks and upward paths, specifically the tunnel that leads upwards, the path of ascension, are all directly related to beings from the Pleiades. and the scoring path of Buddha, the scoring path of what's known as the Great Plug, which means that this plug shows that without some kind of extraterrestrial and/or divine intervention, i.e., the pillar of fire and the cloud of smoke,
right, the column of smoke
by day and night, whatever, leading the Hebrews out of Egypt, etc., that mankind would never have, on our own, we would never have been able to break the chains of these dark lords, if you will. And then what happens is that the upward path, we somehow manage to transcend through the Great Plug. Going beyond that, you then have the incarnation of Buddha as the first of the great messiahs. You then have the incarnation of Christ, and actually it's very interesting because the actual Christ angle in the pyramid, what's known as the Christ Pyramid, which begins September 27th of 2 BC and ends approximately April 1st of 33 AD, known as the central messianic angle in the pyramid. If you draw one angle off this triangle and go off the north wall of the pyramid and you triangulate it, this angle actually cuts through an area called the Sea of Reeds directly outside of Cairo, not the Red Sea, but the Sea of Reeds, where it's believed the Hebrews really escaped from. Then it cuts across the land of Canaan, cuts across a section of the Jordan River, where it is believed that the Israelites actually then entered the Promised Land, and actually triangulates directly at within about 100 yards of the Cave of the Nativity in Bethlehem, showing where the central messianic figure would actually be born. Another fascinating part of this, too, is that if you take the other angle off the pyramid and you actually triangulate it off the south wall of the pyramid, that triangulates at Stonehenge, England, pointing to the point and location where the next messianic figure is to be born. So it is of interest that once you enter, you're in the Grand Gallery, and it's 60 feet high, and it's got concourses, it's got seven level concourses on either side, and to make this simple, there's a great step at the end, which starts about 1844, levels out at 1900. About 1914 is when you enter the antechamber to the King's Chamber. And once you hit the date, February 21st of 1999, the entire building material of the Great Pyramid changes from base granite to red granite, which is sort of a form of rose quartz. It has a very, very high electrical level. It sparkles. It's red granite is what you see whenever you're in the Holy of Holies of anywhere in Egypt. Usually you will see sandstone on the outside, which is common. Granite on the inside, and then the inner temple or the inner sanctuary, the sanctum sanctorum is made out of red granite usually. So the entire building material of the pyramid, as far as the King Chambers goes, on February 21st of 1999 actually becomes red granite. And it shows that there is a 40-year Exodus period in which all of these billions of people that have incarnated on the planet, that in the 40-year period between 1999 and 2039, these people have come here to, in essence, die, to check out of the planet. Their mission's done. There's a huge judgment of the age. We're finally moving out of the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius. Even though the true age of Aquarius, we're in the cusp right now.
Right, right.
The true age of Aquarius doesn't occur until approximately 2150.
And some of the signs are already beginning to show up.
Right. Well, you know, we've seen the 60. I mean, you know, it's not the beginning of the end, but it's the end of the beginning, as they say. So the idea here is that there is some, and this is the only two things I can give you, the one thing out of the pyramid about some kind of intervention, there is a single hieroglyph in the Great Pyramid, and that hieroglyph is a raised semicircle that sits on what's known as the Messianic Eve, and the Messianic Eve is a big block of stone that is at the entrance to the antechamber of the King's Chamber, and the message is that there is the bestowal of a great Messiah, a Christ-like being, who incarnates sometime around 2034, I believe it is, and it actually talks about a great sign in the sky, that there will be some kind of extraterrestrial rescue or appearance or some kind of sign in the sky that brings hope to all humanity, and that this occurs sometime around September of 2034.
Right. And it's called the sign of the Son of Man.
No, it's actually, and then whatever happens is that then the Messiah, the Christ force that incarnates in a human person, supposedly somewhere on October 31st of 2039, and that then begins this next age. So we have a little ways to go according to the pyramid time code. However, in essence, what then happens is that Messiah rules from 2039 until approximately, I think, 2116. Then he or she dies. There are then three walls that then drop across the path, which show that the Earth is actually closed to anyone that's not of a higher enlightened state, that the Earth goes from kind of a crummy, crappy public high school like UCLA
to a paradise
becomes a private university like, you know, say USC. So just had to get my Trojans in there.
Yeah, there you go.
So the essence of this becomes is that my theory on this, what I have extrapolated, is that there are six chakras on the planet. There is Lhasa, Tibet, first chakra, Cairo, Egypt, second chakra, third chakra is Stonehenge, England. Fourth chakra is, it's kind of a balance between Machu Picchu and Easter Island. Fifth chakra is downtown Los Angeles, the throat or communication chakra. And the sixth chakra is Tenri City, directly outside of Osaka, Japan. That the seventh chakra is, in fact, the Messiah. The seventh chakra is the human mind. The seventh chakra is the new sphere that our highest selves create, the single being or individual that comes as a Messiah. That's why there's no capstone to the pyramid. That's why Jesus said, I am the chief cornerstone that the builders rejected. So my theory is that there's evidence in the pyramid that shows that the first one was Buddha, born in the energy of Lhasa and Nepal. The second one was Jesus, born in the energy of Cairo. That the third one is going to be born in the energy of England, specifically somewhere around Stonehenge. And that there will be, if you want to extrapolate forward, that the next Messiah will then come from South America. The next one after that will be from whatever's left of California at that time, and the last one will come from Japan. And this is what, by the way, the Dalai Lama and many Japanese religions talk about, that this is the true Maitreya, that the last of the great Buddhas, the Maitreya, is born, according to the pyramid time coding, in 2489 AD, quite some time from now. And they're the last of the great Buddhas, because after that we don't need Buddhas anymore, and there's about a 500-year period where we live without these messianic figures, and then finally the year 3000 is when the true millennium begins. On the shorter term, there is the Mayan calendar. And if you're actually looking at, there's a fantastic book on this called The Mayan Calendar and the Transformation of Consciousness, and it's by Dr. Carl Johan Kalman. Kalman's in a very interesting debate right now, which I think is kind of fun. It's getting kind of nasty, but there's a debate between John Major Jenkins, who did really the yeoman's work on a lot of the Mayan calendar called Mayan Cosmogenesis, and Carl Kalman, who has compared the Aztec and the Mayan calendars. The real drag of this is that you can actually see a whole series of prophetic events that have occurred along Kalman's index of the calendar. One of these happened to be July 11th of 1991, where it talked about the beginning of the sixth sun and the return of the masters of the stars, and this had a lot to do with the solar eclipse over Mexico City, and as predicted, there were fleets and waves of UFOs that were videotaped all across the world by these craft coming in to visit. It truly was the return of the masters of the stars. Technically, the 90s were just UFOs everywhere. They were flying over cities. They were every place. I just thought it was very interesting that after 9/11, a lot of this, a massive amount of this phenomenon simply stopped. There just haven't been a lot of reports of this. There have been some over Scotland. There have been some over South America, but you know, you haven't had anywhere near the kind of phenomenon that you had from, say, 1991 through about 2001 or so. But here's the interesting part about this is that Kalman, in brief, if I can explain his theory, Kalman talks about how there are three great weeks in the Mayan calendar, and these weeks consist of a what he calls a galactic week, a planetary week, and a national week. The national week is several hundred years long. The planetary week is decades long or hundreds of years long, and the galactic week is approximately about 12-13 years or so. So it is interesting, without explaining all of this stuff, he talks about the fifth night, and all of this has to do with, it's really cool how he's boiled it down. He talks about the dissemination of the core synthesis. And the core synthesis of the Mayans is really simple, that we will achieve an ascending consciousness when we really understand, or when we experience directly the knowledge of, not the understanding, but the direct kind of balls-the-bone knowledge, if you will, that all is one, life has purpose and God is love. Now, that seems like a bumper sticker, but I think that there is no great philosophy that's worth anything if it can't be boiled down to a, you know, to a bumper sticker or a refrigerator magnet.
Right.
Or a fortune cookie. And in this case, you know, all is one means that everything's connected together. Life has purpose means that no matter what's going on with you right now, that your life has a purpose, has had a purpose for billions of years, and it frees you in a lot of ways to say you're exactly at the point you're supposed to be, where you're supposed to be there. And God being love means that the prima mobile of the cosmos is, in fact, that the greatest and highest good for every being of the universe is enacted by the very nature of the universe itself. So,
well, we know from just the commandments that Jesus personally issued, one being, you know, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, and strength.
Right.
And the second is love thy neighbor as thyself, which in perfect Greek fashion, basically, he's saying, look, love yourself.
Preach the gospel, heal the sick. That's what he said to his disciples. So, the challenge of this is that, and this is what's very interesting, is because Calvin talks about the fifth night in both of these calendars. And the fifth night is, not to base it on the negative here, but it's coming very, very soon. I mean, we've got about a month left until this fifth night begins. And it is very interesting how everything I talked about in the previous segment is all building up to some kind of grand dumont coming around in November of this year. The fifth night is what he calls the night of Armageddon or the age of Armageddon, that this is a division of East versus West. This is a huge collapse of monetary and material civilization that is necessary in order to grab those spiritual beings by the scruff of the neck, so to speak, and shake out the fleas. The fifth night in his, so I can get this right, the fifth night in his national calendar lasted from about 420 A.D. until about 600 A.D. or so. And actually, you can trace this directly to it, and he talks about the center of the world tree being Europe and with Germany at its heart as being the catalyst for a lot of these actions. So it is interesting, if you look at this period of time, it directly relates to Attila the Hun and the collapse of the Roman Empire by the Vandals and the Goths and the Visigoths and what have you, and you know, Attila invading the gates of Rome and tossing the spear of Longinus at the gates of Rome. It was the collapse of the Roman Empire in that period of time.
Well, you also had the advent of Islam, and you had Confucianism, and you had Buddha. Everybody showed up about 600.
Right. Well, there you go. Well, about 600 or so. But this is, but it showed up at the end of the fifth night,
right,
when you had this Armageddon factor, which now that you started what they call the sixth day, and each one of these is that there's a day and a night to these years. Each aspect is you have the sixth day and the sixth night. So this is you've had the fifth day, which is the budding of the core synthesis of all is one, life has purpose, God is love. Now you have the core reaction to the positives that are being generated. So that was the national week. The planetary week of the fifth night lasted from 1932 to 1947. Well, again, his timeline says that Germany was going to be at the core of a global Armageddon, and certainly you can point to Hitler and Mussolini and FDR and Churchill and all the players in that global Armageddon, which certainly lasted from 1932 through about 1947 or so.
Sure, you had the post-World War One all the way to, well, just after the first two nuclear weapons were exploded.
So now we're coming up on the fifth night again, and this fifth night, once again, is going to pit East versus West, is going to be a year of Armageddon, is going to be a year of political, economic, and social chaos that is going to be triggered by war, with somehow, again, Europe and Germany in the center of this. And if you're watching what's happened financially now, you have the euro at just an insanely high level. As predicted, you have the euro at $1.40 and beyond. I think it hit a high of something like $1.43.
Oh, yeah. And then you have a desperate attempt at forming what's called a North American Union, which is highly lopsided.
Right.
Basically going to devalue the dollar even more.
Sure. Well, and that's all. And the reason that's all falling apart is because they're trying to turn the United States into sort of the North American Union is basically just going to be one giant Guatemala with nothing but slave labor.
I was just going to say, it's just going to be Northern Mexico is basically what it's going to be.
Yeah, well, that's what it gets, you know. Dude, I live in Los Angeles. It's already here. So, you know, you think that, you know, if you think it's a good thing, you should try traveling to downtown L.A. Try going around USC sometime in downtown Los Angeles if you want to see what northern Mexico looks like.
Yeah, I just wonder why I have to press a number to get my message in English.
Yeah, yeah. That's my John Wayne impression. What do you mean I got to press one for English? which I think is funny. Anyway, the idea behind this is, once again, is that November 17th is the beginning of the fifth night in the Mayan calendar. And it is very interesting that I do not know why, but behind the scenes right now, relations are exceptionally strained between the Germans and the Israelis. And I'm not exactly sure why. I know Angela Merkel has actually given the U.S. pretty much permission to go bomb Iran. The only thing that has saved us so far is that the Israelis have balked. And the Israelis have balked because they want a guarantee from the United States that if we are going to start blowing up Iran, that we are going to hit all the missile sites inside Iran, because the first thing that's going to happen is Iran sends missiles towards either Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, the green zone inside Iraq, and they basically blow up the Straits of Hormuz. And
but I thought Iran didn't have any weapons grade.
Yeah, there you go. Well, they do now, because what happened was is that they got missiles from the Russians. They have something called sunburn missiles, which they got from the Chinese, and they have four nuclear tips, which they got from the Ukrainians. The United States was getting ready to invade, and if Putin gives them something called the Topo missile, it'll be very interesting to see what happens, because the Topo missile can actually change course about seven times before it actually hits its target. So in response to the saber-rattling by the Bush administration, he is in fact creating the nuclear parity that he claims he's trying to stop, if that makes any sense at all. I'm just telling you that November 17th, everything's boiling down for this. The stock market, I mean, and I made a lot of these predictions like 10 years ago, Brooke. I mean, I was talking about in 1997, I said the stock market was going to be between 14.5 and 16,000 right in this period of time before that we would see gold going up and the stock market going up right before we had another crash. Well, gold's up over 700. The stock market's up over 14,000. I said a couple of years ago that we would see the euro in this period of time at $1.40. It is.
And oil's at $84 a barrel.
Oil's at $84 and on its way to 100. And, you know, and all this, I mean, over and over and over again, I have told you everything these guys are up to. I've for whatever reason, there are people with source information that have decided to pick up the phone and call me, because I'm one of the few people that seems to inhabit this very rarefied, almost extinct space, if you will, where I can have access to programs like yours and programs like Coast to Coast and programs like Rick Barber and KOA out of Denver, and that I have a presence because of my pedigree of research and because of the things that I've done. And I mean, when I speak on programs like this, the halls of power shake, Brooks.
I can tell you this, Sean. Normally, we have a lot of telephone calls on this program, but it appears that there are several tens of thousands of people out there just listening right now. They don't want to interrupt what's going on.
Well, I think that's a good thing. I think that maybe, it's a good thing. I try not to disappoint them, and I'm trying to warn them that when these people call me and they tell me about what's going on the inside, you know, they're telling me, Sean, look, when you speak, the halls of power shake. People in Beijing and Moscow and London and Washington, D.C., I mean, there are people out there who are saying, how the hell does this guy know this stuff? How the hell did he get a hold of this type of information? Because this is key core source information about what's going down. And I can tell you this, if there is some kind of radiological or biological attack between now and the end of this year on Portland or Phoenix or Guam, then I can tell you exactly who's behind it. And maybe that's the best warning for me, and maybe the best way to stop whatever's going on. Because I am telling you, there are black ops guys, very, very bad dudes, who are, in essence, trying to come up with a Gulf of Tonkin, Lusitania, Pearl Harbor kind of preemptive attack against the United States that will allow these people to cover themselves in blood and glory, and will allow them to once again con the American public into letting them basically wipe about 4 million people off the face of the earth. And we're not talking again about Excalibur missiles or bunker busters or whatever. We're talking about nuclear devices exploded in the air, designed to wipe out civilian populations and basically designed to wipe out the entire population of Iran. And there are people who get up on the radio, the Michael Savages and the Sean Hannitys and the Rush Limbaughs, and you know, and these murderous jackasses who seem to think that this is all a good idea. And you know, I've got no love for their philosophy, to tell you the truth. Yeah, I think it's kind of crazy. And at the same time, how do you excuse a preemptive strike against a country that's no threat to us, that hasn't attacked us and hasn't really ever done anything to us? And yet that's exactly what we got the American people to believe when we took Saddam out of power. That's exactly what we got them to believe when we invaded a country again in a preemptive strike that had not attacked us, that had no weapons of mass destruction to speak of, and it never used them on anyone.
Well,
so,
unlike Iraq, though, Iran is a very enlightened, very cosmopolitan nation. The people
yeah,
are very
I would go that far, Brooks. I wouldn't really give them that much credit. I mean, there's enlightened and then there's enlightened. There's still kind of a... I'm just saying they're not attacking anybody. I don't agree with them. You know, I don't particularly like them.
Well, I'm not talking about the leadership. I'm talking about the rank
and the people themselves. Look, I've lived in Egypt. You know, the Egyptians don't consider themselves Arabs. They try to distance themselves from a lot of the other crazy aspects of the rest of the Arab world. They are Egyptians. They are not Arabs. There's got to be a way to make peace with these people, and certainly a crusade against them is not the way to do it. But they can be dealt with. They can be. There are business relationships that can overcome a lot of what's going on with this.
Well, that's possible, except that it seems that most of the quote Arab nations have one goal in mind, and that's to push Israel into the sea. They're going to have to come up with a different agenda if they're going to want world peace.
All right. Well, at the same time, I don't know what to tell you about that. It is. We decided that the United States basically decided that we needed military bases in that part of the world to defend our oil. Therefore, we're the ones that pushed to create the State of Israel to put it where it was. We could have put the State of Israel in Arizona. We could have put it in Florida. I mean, they seem to like Florida better anyway. Why don't you should have just put it in Miami Beach?
Well, they could have put it in Utah. The federal government owns 73% of that state anyway.
Point taken. The challenge was that we had to put it there. You know, right in the middle of, you know, and again, we have now fought a war. With the Vietnam War, we lost about 50,000 guys, but we were at least seen by the rest of the world as protecting a country and defending it from the savagery of communism. In this one, we've lost about 5,000 guys and managed to make about 1.5 billion enemies, and have taken on the ire and the hatred of the entire rest of the planet. And I'm not sure when that is ever going to go away. I mean, Americans now still can't travel the world safely simply because of the actions of the current administration.
My friends who come home from Iraq are telling me a different story than the media.
From Iraq or Iran?
Coming home from Iraq.
Yes.
Are telling me that the Iraqi people are overjoyed that we're there, that we're adding stability, we're improving schools, we're hanging electric lights, they have electricity, they have water, they got cell phones for the first time, they have satellite TV, which is now, you know, giving them some kind of knowledge outside of Saddam-controlled Iraq.
So you're saying the situation in Iraq the bad situation in Iraq is nothing more than a massive propaganda campaign?
Well, I
you're
think that it's probably
security
propaganda
and
on both sides.
The billions of dollars that have disappeared in the Halliburton who haven't rebuilt the water and haven't put the cell phone towers back up, and you know, and that private security forces, basically thugs and mercenaries on the payroll of the U.S. government, that's all just a hoax.
Well, I think that the news media is going to show what they want to show.
Okay.
But, you know, my friends are coming back from the streets, and they're coming back from the trucks and the convoys that are moving stuff and building schools and operating hospitals. And I think there are two sides to this story. I think there's a good side. There's a humanitarian side. And I think there's a highly manipulated side that has to do with this, with oil. And you have to think on a national sense, if this country runs on oil, and oil is, you know, threatening to fall into the hands of people who would cut it off and thus stop our trucks from rolling, then maybe we do have a national interest in going in there. But going in there the way we're going in there is just wrong.
Okay, agreed.
It's just wrong. I mean, if we're going to go in there, we need to go in there as businessmen to do business, not as warriors to take and steal and you know, spread imperialism,
well,
so to speak.
The deal was made to send Saddam into exile, give him $1 billion and send him into exile in Egypt, and Bush said, no, we're going to be in Baghdad by March, and, you know, I want that son of a bitch at the end of a rope, unquote. And these are the reports that are now being put out with taped tirades of Bush of when he was planning the attack, of, you know, everything that he was planning on doing in Iraq before he was going in there. And they're pulling the exact same rabbits out of the exact same hats to trick us into thinking that, you know, Iran is the next big threat and that they're the ones that need to be wiped off the face of the earth. And I don't think they're going to get away with it unless there is yet again another provocative strike on the United States, and I can prove systematically that every single supposed attack on the United States has actually been planned by the military-industrial complex, basically attacks upon ourselves.
And who's really in charge of that? Do you think Bush is in charge of that?
No, but he's actually. But I can tell you that the Frontier Group, which are the 230 plus guys who actually spent 90% of the 90% of the campaign financing to get this guy elected, the Frontier Group stands to make billions. I mean, just untold billions. On an expansion of the war into Iran. And as far as he's concerned, I haven't seen anything yet that he's actually done for the American people outside of some, you know, some meaningless social issues.
Yeah.
But anything yet that he's done for the American people that didn't directly benefit his buddies in this group, in the primary Frontier Group, who again stand to make billions off this war, billions upon billions upon billions.
What about the efforts into alternative fuels, biodiesel, ethanol?
I think it's great. I think it's wonderful, and at the same time, I think electric cars are still probably the dumbest invention ever because you're just polluting in one place rather than polluting in a whole bunch of places.
I understand.
Hybrid cars are better. I mean, I have a hybrid car. My wife and I bought one of the first ones, and yet the lithium batteries are non-recyclable and they're only good for about 10 years or so. Ethanol is great. And the corn is great and all that, but you try to run it on a regular car, and it chews up the carburetor, it gums up the spark plugs, it basically shortens the life of your engine by something like 60%. I still think I've seen some fantastic prototypes for electric vehicles that actually just use the electricity to heat water in a car that I think are the best things. BMW, actually, 2008-2009, is coming out with a steam supercharged version of the BMW. I'm not so sure we're running out of oil. I'm not so sure we're actually running out of oil specifically. But, you know, look, I'm all for it. I'm all for anything that's an alternative, anything that's kinder and friendlier on the environment. I would just like to see somebody big get into something legitimate, that something that actually works.
I understand. Well, hopefully that's coming. I think we have a caller. Caller, can you tell us your first name and where you're calling from?
Hello, my name is Haya, and I'm calling from Victoria, British Columbia.
Wow, hey, Canadians, how's it going, eh?
Hello, yeah, I've met you, Brooks, once before.
Oh, hi, well,
the,
how are you? Oh, I'm sorry.
The CETI conference.
Oh, yes, how are you?
Fine, thank you. I've been listening to you talk about the Middle East, and
yeah.
I want to let you know that I've lived in the Middle East for a number of years, especially Israel. And what I see in the Middle East, and knowing the politics that's going on, the atrocities that are going on right now is just horrendous. What you're being told, Brooks, is you've got to look between the lines. Iraq is falling apart, literally, and that's the way they want it to be. They want to separate and divide the people and conquer them, essentially.
Right.
They have absolutely no intentions of getting out of there, unfortunately. And as far as the Israelis, I'm absolutely astonished when I see walls around the Palestinians. When I was there late 1980, they weren't there. And it reminds me of Nazi Germany when they walled the people around, and that makes me disgusted. And considering the fact I'm a Jew myself, I think it's abhorrent.
Yes, I believe that. I understand that. When I look at aerial photos of that area, I look at one side of the wall is nice and green and lush, and the streets are clean, and the other side just looks like a train wreck. It's all dusty and trash filled, and there's no irrigation. I don't know what's going on over there.
Well, I'd say the Zionists are taking control of the country, which is absolutely terrible, because I do know that there's Jewish groups working with our groups, trying to help, and they're being condemned for it.
I agree. I'm on the caller's side, Brooke.
Oh, okay, yeah. They are being condemned for it on a major scale. And as far as Iran's concerned about the president of Iran saying they're going to bomb Israel right into, that's a lie. That's an out-and-out lie. He never, ever said that. And whoever put that on the air needs to be put in prison for leading people down the wrong road on what he said. That's not exactly what he said at all.
He actually said that if Iran was attacked by Israel, that they would defend themselves. That's what he said. And that's actually the real drag here because what you're about to see, any country in the world wouldn't defend themselves.
Yeah, I can hear you. By another country.
What I was going to say is that what you're going to have to see is that whatever the United States is going to do, whether it's an attack inside the United States on one of our cities here, they're going to have to make it look as though Israel is being attacked and that the United States is actually coming to its rescue, and that that's the only
well,
way.
Well, we know that they've already targeted
going to be able
Portland
to do this.
And other places.
And if I can,
I've been keeping with Alex Jones too. I've been a good listener to Coast to Coast, and I'm listening to all alternatives. I listen to your radio station as well. And I have been discouraging people. I'm just calling the normal television the idiot box because really.
Oh yeah, I have to agree there. I'm telling people just turn the news
really
off.
People believe what they hear on it.
Yeah, it's completely engineered.
Well, again, it's going to be very interesting to see how this comes down, because again, this goes back to exactly like the consciousness and enlightenment that we're talking about. There's been enough research now into the events around 9/11. My personal belief is that 40 years from now, as many people will believe that the Arabs had something to do with 9/11 as today believe that Oswald acted alone in the Kennedy assassination. I think that there's enough people, and this is the real rift, because you've got, you know, Rudy 9/11 Giuliani. You've got Hillary Clinton on the other side as the two big candidates, both of which are candidates for death and war. And you have to vet a candidate by whether or not they're going to increase the troops. And again, they're not offering anything different. They're simply saying, well, I'd send more troops, I'd send less troops. The United States is going to be in Iraq forever as it stands now. We're spending millions of dollars on the embassy. As a matter of fact, everything in the current embassy is broken, and they're having to spend another $160 million fixing it. Next year, next spring, the British are planning on actually deploying another 20,000 Royal Air Force Rangers into Afghanistan. So all I'm seeing behind the scenes here, kids, is a further escalation of the occupation and the conflict in Iran, an expansion of the conflict into Iran. And if you really want to look at it this way, I mean, it looks like from a religious perspective, you can talk about Zionist control in the United States, Zionist control of the media, Zionist control of Israel, of basically that Israel is in fact a captive population, that you've got about 6 million people in Israel being ruled by a Zionist faction that is hurtling Israel quite possibly towards its own destruction, of which the people
well,
in
exactly
Israel themselves are.
And on top of it, you want to take a look at the food that's being sent over. It's on all the different countries. You've got to watch for the food because what do you say when you control the food source, you control people?
Yeah. Sure.
And the foods are tainted. They're changing the food, even the food that you're eating today. I mean, they're putting all sorts of garbage in.
I'm not sure what
that is doing
for what we're talking about. But
And it's done in a very sneakily way. It's like I'm part of the Canadian Action Party here, as well as the 911, because we can see what's happening. And we're kind of looking at the states here, like, God forbid, it turns into a fascist government. They already committed.
Well, I understand all of this.
And Harper is not behind him, and we're trying to get Harper out. He's a crooked.
Well, actually, Brooksy, let me finish my one thought here. When you have the president of the United States who believes in what you call Yitzhak Israel or Greater Israel, that Israel has to have either hegemony or control over all of the original lands of Canaan promised it by God, which includes big chunks of Egypt and Lebanon and Syria, Damascus, big chunks of Iraq and sections of Persia, and that when the Israelis get this hegemony or rulership over this area, that somehow this will mean that we will all be raptured and Jesus is coming back. Now, that's a wonderful mythology that millions of people believe.
Yeah,
but when that becomes the foreign policy of the United States of America, that's when it gets to be really, really dangerous, because we have a president. I'm sorry, we got two people talking at once.
Hang on, Kaya. Let him finish his point. We only have about 60 seconds left.
The scientists themselves are just to their own people.
Go ahead, and let Kaya talk. Go ahead.
I understand. Kaya, thank you for the phone call. And call back on another program, because we've got about 60 seconds left.
Let me just do this. SeanDavidMorton.com, DelphiAssociates.org. I've got the Delphi Associates newsletter. The newsletter you have to have today because it tells you all about tomorrow. The book, actually, you can go on Amazon.com. My latest book is called Black Seraph. It's being reviewed and advertised in Nexus Magazine. It's a fantastic true spy story. It's sort of a Vatican thriller. That's climbing up the charts. Great stuff. The Delphi Associates newsletter is $65 for a one-year, 12-issue subscription. It's a full-color, 20-page magazine that has all the latest stuff. And I just want to say it's a pleasure spending time with as brilliant and as bright and as cosmic a mind as yourself, Brooke. So thank you very much.
I appreciate it. And next time you have one of these news breaks that you need to get out, just give me a call. We'll give you some time and get it out there.
All right, buddy. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you both. Thanks, Sean, for being on the program. Kaya, thank you so much for calling in. We are out of time, and we'll be back next week with more of X Squared Radio. Thank you so much for being part of our program. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth explorers.